Everybody, thank you for listening. This is Sinead, and you're listening to Firestarter Radio on Renegade Broadcasting. The date today is December 13th, 2016. So tonight on the show, in the first hour and some odd minutes, I'm going to be speaking with $6 million Gas Bill, who is new to YouTube, and she's been doing some really awesome videos, and she has a ton of research and notes compiled. So we had a really, really great chat. We talked a little bit about Christianity. We talked about how she has woken up to a lot of this stuff recently. We talked about the importance of motherhood and childbirth. We talked about just about everything. We went all over the place. So it's an interesting discussion. We also touched on the Kekka Law that Kyle and I discussed on his show on Sunday, and she's the woman who brought this up to me, and she's done the research into this, so she shares her research with us about that. And we also talk about a little bit of behavior shaping when it comes to white male aggression being punished while non-white male aggression is rewarded and passivity of white males is rewarded. So that's the basics of how you shape a behavior, and that's exactly what's being done. So that's it for the first hour. And in the second hour, I'm going to be going solo, talking a little bit about some of the weird practices that these Orthodox Jews do in regards to women, and how the Bible even has these kind of views of women being unclean and being basically just like animals. So we're going to talk about that. We're going to go over what the Bible thinks of women. And we're also going to talk about this very interesting theory that the World Trade Centers, well, the first two that were demolished, had absolutely no floors except for maybe a few at the top and a few at the bottom. And it was actually just a big radio antenna. I know it sounds weird, but just come along with me for the journey. And also that the new Freedom Tower might also not have any floors. And it's just another big radio tower or radio mast. So what kind of signals are they broadcasting? What was their intention in demolishing these things? I think they wanted to do something beyond the realm of what we can see. There was some kind of spiritual energetic shift or impact that happened on that day. And we're going to talk a little bit about that. So hope everybody enjoys the show. Oh, a few little housekeeping things that I need to get to before I forget. If you would like to order a DVD of The True Story of Whites in South Africa, I am now taking DVD orders. All you have to do is go to whitesouthafrica.com. And if you click on the donate link, if you want a DVD shipped, you know, within America, it's $20 and international is $30. I know it seems like a lot, but it really costs me a lot of money to ship these things internationally. So I wish I could do it cheaper, but I have to not actually lose money because I have no money to lose. So think of it as a nice donation towards a good cause if you feel so inclined. Go ahead and order one of those. And also, I want to let people know that I am planning a small, small but mighty speakers event with the Soidlanders. They're a group from South Africa, a defense group that is going to be coming to the United States at the end of January and coming to Florida for one of their stops. And I want to rent out a little small community center. I've looked into some of the prices. It's very doable. And I want to have a screening of the documentary, and I also want to have them speak, and I can live stream the event. I'll probably have to set up a new channel for that, though, because all of my permissions have been taken away because I've been a bad goy. So I want to live stream it. I want to record it on, you know, on some good cameras, some good sound equipment, as good as we can get. And obviously invite anybody that wants to come. And if I can raise enough money or set enough money aside, I wouldn't have to charge an admission. But if I did, it would be like $5 to get in. And it just helps to pay for the venue, so we don't have to like be outside at a park doing this when it's a little bit chilly in January. Not that cold, but we don't want to be outside. So I already have a young lady that is planning on coming to this event. I'm really excited. I know I have some other contacts in Florida that might be interested, but if you want to travel, you know, I'm sure we can find affordable accommodations for people. It's worth the travel if you're in, you know, the Georgia area, if you want to just drive down. I'm going to do it on a weekend. I'm thinking probably a Sunday because I usually work Saturdays. But if that doesn't work, I can maybe move around my schedule. So if you feel like you might be able to make it, please get in touch with me. You can contact me through the Heathen Women's contact form at heathenwomen.com, and that'll go directly to my email. So I just want to get a rough head count. We're looking for around January 19th through the 21st, somewhere in that window, and it would be in the Central Florida area, the Orlando and surrounding area. I'm not going to give out the location yet. So if you're interested, please get in contact with me about that. And I believe that's all that I had to get to with housekeeping stuff. So we'll get to the show now. Thanks, everybody, and I will be back next week. Take care.
Okay, we are recording, and I am joined with, I'll say this, the full name, and then we'll refer to you as Six from there on out. But I have $6 million gas bill from YouTube with me. Hello.
Hello, everybody. So good to be here. Thank you.
Absolutely. It's really nice to finally get to chat with you. You've been having my back in the comment sections, and I appreciate that.
Yeah, well, I mean, I thought it was so funny. All these trolls were saying that I was you, and they were egging me on to make a video with my face and everything. And I thought about it for about 5 seconds, and I just thought, you guys don't deserve to even know what my face even looks like.
It's, no, they don't.
I mean, this is just like absolutely ridiculous, the amount of lies and rumors they're trying to spread to discredit. I mean, there's a few, a handful of women like yourself, myself, Avalian, and a couple others that I've connected with. We're all of like mind, and it's absolutely wonderful and refreshing to be able to connect with these other women and talk about these ideas openly. And the fact that we were just saying before the show started, our enemies are so desperate to discredit us. I mean, just the lies and the rumors they're trying to spread about you is just, it's absolutely pathetic. And anyway, I take it as a good sign that's what they need to do.
I totally agree. And that's why I never even censor it, because I'm like, they're just making themselves look so desperate. You know, they come up with a new thing every day. She's a tranny. She has a biracial child.
Yeah.
I mean, no matter.
There's some video or some photo of you sitting next to a black guy, and they're like, she race mixed. And it's just so ridiculous. Like, I mean, if you live in a metropolitan city and you weren't born Jew-wise, like nobody was, there's probably a lot of photos of me with Asian people. You know, I grew up on the West Coast. There's a lot of Asian people. That doesn't mean I race mixed with Asian people. Right. It's just I happen to know a lot of Asian people. I've worked with a lot of Asian people. There's pictures of me in, like, company Christmas photos with all types of people of all different races. You know, it doesn't mean we all had a big, nasty orgy afterwards. I mean, only in the imagination of a disgusting, subversive Jew could such a scenario even be painted and written in a comment section. So I love how easily they out themselves with very, very little pressing. The fact that they have an agenda is very, very clear. So, but I do like to nip it in the bud and at least point it out in case someone stumbles on your channel and doesn't really know what you're about yet. you know, I think most people with two brain cells to rub together would stick around long enough to see, but I don't know. I guess call me crazy. That's just my compassion as a woman. You know, if I see any perfectly good white guys out there who are just a little brainwashed, I want to do what I can to kind of help dust them off and bring them on over to the, out of the dark side.
Yes, that's a good way of putting it, the dark side. Because really, a lot of their anger is being misplaced and put onto women. And, you know, that's our enemy's tactic, right? Like, they're going to take all of the anger and rage that they should rightly feel and direct it at their partners.
Right, yeah. And I've been thinking about this a lot. I haven't come to certain conclusions on this yet, but it is, I think we can all agree that the Daily Stormer has sort of crowned itself the leader of the alt-right in terms of website material and online material. And I actually only, even before I had misgivings about the movement, I'll admit I was really, before I was G-wise, I was really excited to hear that a non-career politician was actually going to be running for president. I thought, well, hey, at least that changes things up. It's not that I was ever like a major Trump train supporter, but you know, compared to Hillary, I thought, well, at least it was same old story. It's like, well, he's the lesser of two evils.
Right.
And plus the fact that he's not a career politician, this could bode well for America. Mm-hmm. So I was never anti-alt-right in the beginning. But it's true that the closer to the election we got, the more I noticed, this woman hatred going on, which is so funny because men and women naturally want to be around each other.
Of course.
I mean, right? Like, think about like the efforts that they've had to go to, which have been perhaps, of course, easier when you own 95% of the media. It's easier to do it. But still, you know, it's a heroic effort to try to get men and women to not want to be around each other in this way. And I am convinced that, and it's been this way throughout history, there is always a larger cohort of males who don't necessarily get to pass their genetics on. Right. I think that's just, you know, for better or worse, for moral or not moral, that's the way nature has been. And there is always going to be a group of men who sort of are disenfranchised, sort of at the lower rungs of the male hierarchy. And I think in Western societies, we do a lot better with that because we don't practice things like polygamy.
Yes.
So there are more mates to go around, but there, you know, I don't think that phenomenon ever really goes away. I believe it's a pretty high percentage throughout history. I think it's something like 40% of the men who've ever existed never got to pass on their genetics. So, I mean, this is a phenomenon that exists in the world, and I believe it's been leveraged highly. Not to mention all the facts or the subversive and degenerative cultural impacts that have been assaulting our young men for several decades now. And one of them, of course, is feminism, which was another Jewish invention. It was pioneered by a lot of I don't know if they were notable women before the movement, but they're now notable women and they're Jewish, Gloria Steinem being one of them. So it's all problem, reaction, solution.
Absolutely.
And with the alt-right, I'm just seeing more and more of this leveraging of hatred towards women for their, you know, their crimes of the past, as though feminism was a crime that you and I committed. I mean, I don't know about you, but when I came out of the womb, I wasn't like, ha, 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 here I am.
Fight the patriarchy. Good God.
Yeah, exactly. Fuck men. Fuck people. No, when I was a little girl, like, I had little baby dolls and I wanted to be a mom. And, you know, like that, I was just a normal little girl.
Oh my gosh, yes.
I wasn't brainwashed. All I wanted to do was have babies. And, you know, when my other sibling was born, I was like, I adored him. You know, I loved babies. I always have loved babies. And even with all the feminist brainwashing, I don't know how I came out as unscathed as I did, but I always thought it was absolutely ridiculous. You know,
absolutely. You know, it's funny because I went to actual university for 2 years. I did my first 2 years at an acting and film conservatory, and then I went back for, you know, my psychology. So I'm really surprised that I did not get this heavy feminist programming, because even when I was in college, which was 2012, I graduated. It wasn't that long ago.
Yeah.
I I still was like, I don't understand this hardcore feminism where they don't want men to open the door for them. You know, I really like chivalry. I love being treated like a, you know, I love a man treating me like a lady, you know, opening the door and giving me a kiss and helping me. And he's stronger. Open this. I can't open it. You know, I like that.
I know. I know. And I guess I've sort of noticed that it does tend to be the women who are and I don't say this to be mean, and maybe it's just because, you know, female aesthetics have not been what they used to be. You know, all this fashion changing all the time, and this androgyny that's being pushed. At the same time, young women have this desire to fit in and do what's popular, so they follow the fashion trends. But when that fashion trend is like a Justin Bieber haircut, you know, you're not going to be getting the same kind of attention from men as right. you would if you had like long feminine hair, or even, you know, a shorter but feminine haircut. So yeah, I think there's kind of, there's so many different, influences, on young women today. It's hard for them to know, like, well, what do I do? You know, the trends are telling me to do this, but maybe I'm not getting, you know, the male attention that I want. And it's, you know, I think when you're young and you don't yet have a larger context within which to understand the world, it's very easy to blame the problems of your life on other people. Mm-hmm. And if you're, if you're not getting the reaction you're expecting from men, but you're doing everything, you know, quote unquote, right, as far as what the culture is telling you is the cool thing to do, I don't know, I guess it could breed some resentment. And I have had a few female friends growing up where they would always say, like, I don't really feel pretty. And, you know, they, not all of them, you know, I can't generalize, but there are a few that kind of maybe just got a little bit bitter in the end.
Yeah.
But mm-hmm. the feminism thing, you know, it's not by accident that when we see, some of the most hardcore feminists out there, you know, they do tend to have masculine haircuts, and
yes,
they sort of have adopted that rainbow aesthetic of, you know, colored hair. And you know, and I've seen that on women where it actually looks very beautiful and very feminine and very mm-hmm. tasteful, but there's just sort of this, I don't know, I think a distasteful, overdone look about it that, you know, men just don't go for that.
No.
It's in their biology, and you really can't blame them for it. It's how they found the best mates, you know, just like 40% of men didn't pass on their genes. I think it was something like 20% of women also didn't. So again, there's always been that cohort of women that are disenfranchised and have trouble finding mates. And if they're, I think those are probably the ones who are more likely to be influenced by what's going on in the culture, because they're trying to find ways to get what they need or get what they want. Whereas like, I'm not like drop dead gorgeous, but like I've never had issues attracting men before. And I never felt that cutting my hair, or like, I'd be horrified if my hair got cut off actually.
Oh, me too.
It's something that I've always liked about the female aesthetic, is nice long hair and natural looking makeup and, you know, clothes that are tasteful and, you know, not trying to show too much. And I kind of have always just been naturally attracted to those aesthetics. But yeah, I was lucky. I didn't necessarily feel the need to do anything different about my looks. But back to this alt-right business, you know, I've really noticed, the women hatred, and I know a lot of other people have noticed this too. And, I'm going to go way on a limb here. So, you know, humor me for a moment, but
let's do it.
Yeah. I find it interesting that, you know, before I was Jewish, I was aware that there were issues in Europe with all the Muslims. So I did spend a number of hours looking into what Islam is all about. So, you know, and I'm a bit of an obsessive researcher. So when I say a number of hours, I probably mean, you know, about 100 hours, you know, really, really looking into it and figuring out what this stuff is about. And, you know, how am I going to recognize it when I see it? So I know to, you know, protect myself from it. And I'm seeing similar sentiments being expressed on the Daily Stormer.
Yes.
And it's really interesting when you read through some of the comments, and I'm convinced that most of these are just, you know, JDIF trolls mm-hmm. or, you know, paid controlled opposition, but you do see in there the odd white guy who's just, he looks so confused. It's like he's stuck between a rock and a hard place.
Yeah.
Right? Like he's told like this alt-right is going to be what saves his country and what brings his mm-hmm. women back to sanity. And it's true. Feminism is certifiably insane. Like it, I completely agree. It should be done away with. But you know, the alt-right is not the means to do that. So he's looking at this alt-right website, and they're kind of like, I think they're kind of a little confused. Like, why are we hating on women? Aren't we supposed to, like, I thought the whole point was to get with women, right? Like, I want a woman. That's why I'm here. I want women. Like, why are we hating on them, right? So, I can see the odd comment of a guy like that who's kind of like, he doesn't want to leave because he's like, well, the rest of the culture's just kicked me around my whole life. And yeah, that's true.
And then they get belittled and bullied for sticking up for women. You pussy white knight.
I know.
Gang mentality.
Yeah, remind me, after I finish on this remark, I'd like to talk about animal domestication, because that's one of the things you would do to domesticate an animal, is you would reward non-aggressive behaviors punish aggression. And they do this only with white men. With all other non-white men, their aggression is rewarded.
You're absolutely right. Wow. Those are basic behavioral principles about how you shape behavior.
Exactly. Exactly. So let's get back to that, because I have a few other
points. I'll write a note that. Here.
Yeah. But as far as the alt-right goes, yeah, I do see this sort of schizophrenia in there, where the whole point of it, I thought, was because, you know, this is a reaction to feminism. Feminism was a cancer on society. We really should be moving past this, you know, what I feel is like cultural dead weight, and getting back to something more traditional.
Yeah.
And in the beginning, it seemed like the alt-right was purporting to stand for white nationalist values. Mm-hmm. And that seemed okay to me. So not that I ever identified as alt-right, because I'm not American, but, you know, I thought, great, this is wonderful to see a movement that's actually going back in the direction to, you know, the older ways that worked, because these are behaviors that have been honed over hundreds of thousands of years, and in a couple generations, we've just done away with them, and it's making us not just upset and unhappy, but I think it's actually causing a large amount of stress in people's lives, mm-hmm. which is leading them to actually become sick. So, it's completely natural that all of these guys were so attracted to the alt-right in the first place. But there is, the schizophrenia of like, well, I thought we were here to get women. And now it's like we hate them. So mm-hmm. I do see a little bit of that on the Daily Stormer. But here's the funny thing I kind of noticed. So in combination with all this controlled opposition that's going on, namely with the Daily Stormer, but there's, of course, a few other there's many other controlled opposition media sources out there related to the alt-right. I just see a lot of parallels with Islam. And I couldn't help but wonder if this was, you know, if they can't trick us into accepting Islam outright. So if they could find a way to bring Islam through the back door and brainwash this generation of fathers, if in fact they do end up fathering any children at all, or at least brainwash this generation of voters, because, you know, let's face it, the kids go to school and they can brainwash them anyway, regardless of who their parents are or what their parents think. But yeah, if they can brainwash this generation of voters into adopting these sentiments about women, and, you know, telling them that the reason they had any issues in their entire life, not being able to get a girlfriend or anything like that, it's all the fault of feminism. Well, I mean, it's not that that's untrue, but, you know, we have to look at, well, where did feminism come from?
Right. What is the root cause of feminism? You know?
Yeah. Yeah. And it's clearer to me every day. This is classic problem reaction solution.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So we have, some prominent Jewesses back in the 1970s really pushing the feminist values on women, and it seems to have taken off again just in a small cohort of women, and it's exaggerated to a degree that I think is really not a match with reality as far as women wanting traditional values back. I think this is just maybe slightly a little bit of conjecture, but if we look at the 53% of white women who voted for Trump, you know, again, Hillary was obviously an awful, awful choice if you have two brain cells to rub together. But, you know, I can't remember the name of the blog, but they had done a you did a video on it. You covered the patterns of women voting, women's voting patterns. And not even just with this past election, but if we look at the voting patterns over time, white women vote conservatively.
That's right.
Overwhelmingly, they vote conservatively, regardless of what the cultural climate is at the time. So I do believe there is, within our genetics, you know, there's only so much feminism we will tolerate before, you know, we feel it in our instincts that that's not the right thing.
Yep, absolutely.
And, right? We just instinctually, white women don't want that. And even if some of them may parrot the right lines just so that they don't get completely rejected by society, you know, when they go to the voting booth, they vote conservative, regardless of what they may say when they're sitting in the classroom or, you know, sitting around other people who may be more more liberal minded, especially if they live in one of the bigger cities. So we see a rejection from white women of feminism. You know,
right. And you'll see, too, you know, the alt-right, they like to use stats that are not broken down racially. For example, they love to use the Austrian elections where it's illegal to break down racial demographics. Now, how many Jews are living there? How many non-whites are living there? So anyone that's grouping white women in with all women of other races is a cultural Marxist because they believe that all races are equal.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, and speaking of other races, the Daily Stormer. I mean, I call it the Daily Race Mixer sometimes just as a joke. It's the amount of white woman hatred is so virulent. It almost makes me nauseous. Just, I mean, I don't,
I want that. Not us. That's not our people. That's so Jewish.
I know. It is so, so Jewish and Islamic almost. It looks like
they're cousins.
They are. And, you know, again, with the encouraging aggressive behavior in non-whites and encouraging white men to be non-aggressive, we see this in Christianity and Islam, too.
Yes.
So in Islam, it's very much rewarded in society when a man is violent, when he is misogynistic. You know, these are the values that they uphold as meaning that you're a man. And of course, that flies in the face of all of our instincts as white people. I mean, again, it personally makes me nauseous to think that a man would actually be stupid enough to buy into that sort of thing. And it has a lot to do with the lower IQs, and we can get to that later too. But yeah, in Christianity, and I don't say this to be mean to Christians. Like I've met a lot of really solid, good Christian men in my life. You know, it's not that it gets them all.
Right.
But it's dangerous because whatever Christianity had started out to be in the beginning, it is a far cry from what it originally was, I think.
Absolutely.
Whatever that was. I don't know. I can't say, but you know, if we can argue that in the beginning it was an appropriate religion for white people, it is no longer so.
And no, they're embracing the genocide.
Exactly. And it has turned them into masochists where if you do something that is bad for yourself or bad for your race or, you know, harmful to your race or your people, it is something to be rewarded.
Yeah. Praise. You're so great. What a great person you are.
To be a martyr, right?
Yes.
So not to be a hero. Not to do heroic deeds, but to meekly lay down your weapons and love your enemies while they raid your country and rape your women. And you're told that you will be given rewards in the afterlife for this masochistic behavior. And again, you gotta step away from get your nose off the wall and take a few steps back and see the big picture. Christianity, it may have been appropriate for white people at the beginning. I can't say for sure. I don't know enough about it. But the fact is, if you take a rational look at it today, it's very damaging. It's masochistic. Mm-hmm. And white people, we're not like that.
No.
You know, they've had to really make people fear you know, with fire and brimstone, like look at the threats of violence that had to be, white people had to be threatened with in order to ascribe to this religion and to practice these masochistic ways.
Yeah. And it's all based on guilt. You know, you're born a sinner, you know, you're tainted and you have to grovel at the feet of Jesus for forgiveness.
Right. And you know, if God is so perfect, why would he create a sinner?
That's a great point, right?
It makes no sense. And even if, you know, if you were, think about it, you know, any good person with a good heart, if you had a creation that was your child and your child made a mistake, would you throw them into a fire pit for all eternity? You know, like we have to be logical about this. No kind-hearted person would ever eternally punish their child for making a mistake, you know, and any punishment, the whole point wouldn't be to hurt them. It would be to reinforce a more healthy behavior because you care about them. You know, it wouldn't be an indefinite punishment for the rest of your life or the rest of eternity because you're an evil sinner. That's just not the way a loving God would approach its creation. So I do think Christianity is, in its present day form, not a healthy mindset to be in if your race is being genocided. So again, along with that slur, it's a slur against a white man to call him a white knight. And the theme is consistent in Christianity as well, where if you do heroic deeds, you're violent or you're a bad person, and you should love your enemies. When you know, well, what if your enemies want to come and rape your wife and cut your head off?
Right?
Should you, right? Like, what do you do then? Would a loving God punish you for self-defense? Right? You know, if you think about it, like if you were locked in a cage and there was a wild animal that was going to eat you and you had a gun and you had the ability to save your own life and shoot the animal dead. Well, you're both God's creation and nature decrees that, you know, the strong survive, and we have instinctually within us this instinct to survive. So, you know, that's a God-given instinct. Are we betraying God then if we stray from those instincts and desecrate his creations? You know, these are serious questions that Christians, especially white Christian men, need to ask themselves. And perhaps it's easier for them to maybe consider what Christianity was maybe meant to be. And I think, you know, if Jesus was this hero that stood up against the Jews, then, you know, in the spirit of that heroism, you know, that's what you should be emulating, you know, not this masochism where you're supposed to basically be a doormat for any violent non-white invader who might decide to come and, you know, suck off the welfare teat in your country. Mm-hmm. You know, these are not healthy behaviors, but I digress too far from the earlier point, but it's, you know, I see this with the alt-right. It's very Islamic, the values that are being pushed about women. Mm-hmm. And anyone who's studied a little bit about Islam, they'll know that the God, the name they use for their God is Allah, and the prophet that they had was called Muhammad, and Muhammad was considered to be the perfect man, and all good, quote-unquote, good Muslims are supposed to follow in the footsteps of how Muhammad lived his life, to even the smallest detail, such as when you enter the bathroom, which foot you're supposed to use. Otherwise, you know, you'll get a demon flying up your butt or something. You know, it's very
neurotic.
Yeah, it's very neurotic. It's very superstitious. And it makes it so men's loyalty to Allah or to Muhammad replaces the loyalty and love that they would have had for their wives.
Which is super gay.
It is very, very homosexual. It's very homosexual.
And they have to get down on their knees and put their butt up in the air for Muhammad every day, like several times a day.
And if you were going to be butt raped, what position would you be in?
Mm-hmm. It's kissing the ground. It's so gay.
It's very, very homosexual. And, you know, just to compound problems and make them worse, they do practice polygamy.
Yep.
So, you know, you have a handful of men at the top who've got something like 20 wives. And then, you know, as you trickle down the hierarchy, you know, they've got, you know, maybe 10 wives and then 5 wives and then, you know, 2 wives. But then there's going to be this group of men at the bottom who don't get any wives at all. Mm-hmm. So they are basically stuck with children and animals. Yep. unless they're at war and they are able to take sex slaves as war booty, which, you know, and this is how they probably get to sell this idea to these men too, because they're not getting women. So let's sell this idea of violence and rape in order to get pussy.
And also go ahead.
Oh, and we see this in the alt-right.
Definitely. And they're inundated with porn, so much porn that they think that these white women are all whores that want to be, you know, just walked up to and completely raped, because a lot of this porn is simulating rape, if not actually documenting rape, where, you know, oh, the woman, she wanted it as she's like screaming and tied up. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I can't remember the website, but I was looking for statistics on that recently, and I believe it's 90% or slightly above 90% of the pornography films ever made cast a white woman as the porn star.
Of course.
And it's not that there's any shortage of non-white porn stars. There are certainly many of them out there. It's just that they want to cast the white woman because there's an agenda behind the porn industry to make white women appear to be something that they're not. And it's like Pavlov, the scientist who trained dogs to salivate at the sound of a bell. You know, what he would do is ring a bell, and then every time he rang the bell, he'd bring food to the dog. And then after so many times of doing that, all it would take to make the dog salivate is ringing the bell. Mm-hmm. So it's in much the same way, not just men in Western countries, but men all over the world who have internet access are being trained like Pavlovian dogs to think horror when they see a white woman.
That's right.
Because 90%+ of the porn videos out there have had white women cast as porn stars. Yep. It's simple Pavlovian response training. And I, you know, growing up, so a funny story, when I was in university, a good friend of mine, she was actually Jewish. And again, this is so long ago, I had no idea about any of the cultural subversion that was happening, but I found it interesting. Like she just would push me often to like, well, why don't you go make it with that guy? Or like, she was very, very promiscuous. And looking back now, I just thought like, oh my God, you know, she was really trying to get me to go along with all of this like promiscuous behavior of hers.
Mm-hmm.
And I did have a one night stand in university, and I just felt so dirty after that. That was the only time that happened to me. And it was all because she was pushing for it. You know, like she had met these, guys at our university bar. One of them was like a fashion model or something. And she was, it's like she set the whole thing up almost. Wow. Like looking back at it now, it's really weird to think about. Like, I thought this girl was my friend. She was not my friend, apparently. Wow. She was really, really pushing for this. And, you know, my instincts were against it. But again, there was that sense of like, well, I'm being ridiculed. So like, what do I do? So, you know, I can really relate to some of these men who are, you know, they're both attracted to the alt-right, but they're kind of not sure about it still, right? Because there is all this hatred about women, and they want women. That's why they're there.
Exactly.
But it does look more and more to me like if the alt-right had its way, I mean, we would just sort of have like a Sharia law system where these guys get to like rape white women and punish them for being out of line. And that's not the way we did things back in pagan times. You know, even they say like, well, we need to return to patriarchy. And It's like, okay, you say patriarchy, but what you're describing is gatriarchy. Yeah, you're describing Sharia law, basically. Like, you should be allowed to beat your wife. And if we go far enough back in the past, what was it about whites in Northern Europe that made them survive? It wasn't that men were telling women what to do. No, we had to be a team.
That's right.
We had to work as a partnership, and the greater tribe together. Women and men, of course, have their divisions of labor, things that they're best at. Women are, nature gave us the ability to have children. We are naturally better at having children and raising children. We're more emotionally in tune. We're generally more emotionally sensitive. That is our strength. That's an enormous strength when it comes to raising children. Men tend to be more less minded about, the internal affairs in the home and more about the perimeter of the home. Mm-hmm. What's happening in their nation, politics, culture, a healthy man anyways, protecting their homeland from any danger or invaders that might threaten the security and future of their children. So, mm-hmm. We do have different mindsets naturally and different things that we're best at. But when it comes to discussing, how do we solve this issue? How do we solve this problem? Because, you bet they had a lot of problems to solve trying to survive those cold winters. They had to be very inventive. And if a woman had a good idea that is something that would have saved people from starving or given them a leg up on survival, do you think they would have scoffed at her and told her to shut up, go back to the kitchen? No.
No.
They would have said, great idea. We want to survive this winter. Let's do that.
Yeah, I keep hearing this talking point from the alt-right that, women have never contributed anything to society. There are no women innovators. There are no women composers. Well, a lot of that has to do with the fact that we were not allowed to be educated for a large period of time. And people like Hypatia were murdered for trying to learn math.
Yeah.
It was kind of impossible for us to do those things when we're being killed and burnt at the stake for trying to learn how to read.
Yeah, and they truly aren't going far back enough into the past because this cultural subversion, it's really been going on a long time. This is nothing new. And even a couple hundred years ago, it was considered acceptable for men to beat their women with a stick, and the rule of thumb, you should, right? You don't beat her with a stick larger than your thumb. That's very Islamic. That's very Judaic, right? Like they've been pushing this on us for a very, very long time. And it just, it's kind of like the more I get to know the white race and what we're really made of, the more I lose all the fear that I have, because we are formidable, after all these centuries of them trying to change us and turn us into something that we're not, there's something in the spirit inside of us that longs to express everything that it is. And we feel it when something is not quite aligned with that, and there's this instinct to return to that. And when I started learning about ancient paganism, it was just like, wow, I felt like I'd come home.
Yes, in a way. Definitely.
It was very, very much an easy fit for me when I started learning about it. So yeah, I do see this attempt again, sort of in the alt-right, to bring back these ways of patriarchy where, men rule and women make babies and shut up and stay out of the way.
Yep, definitely. And
if that had been the way our ancestors had done that in Northern Europe, we would not be here right now.
That's
We found, right? We found a way that was optimal for our survival, and that it really culled us in a way into being the superior, having some of the superior qualities that we have. Because if you weren't willing to cooperate with the whole tribe, you would have been dead weight, I'm sure, and exiled, because, if you're not willing to pull your weight and contribute to the survival and the well-being of everybody, I just can't see them having, with limited resources, a reason to keep them around.
Exactly.
And I'm sure it was just that brutal at times. So instinctually, we don't This is not the way white people do things at all.
No, it's definitely not. And since we're on the topic of Abrahamic religions and the alt-right, I wanted you to tell us a little bit. Kyle and I touched on it last night because you introduced me to this information that Kek Allah is found in the Quran. What is it, 41 times?
Actually, it turns out it's only 12. But still, there's a dozen instances of it. I thought it was more. I hadn't yet read through all of them. I was still in the midst of translating the first page, but there was like 5 pages of search results. So when I counted all the search results, it was 41. Okay, but gotcha. Actually, yeah. But just to be precise with it, yeah. If you look in the Malay version, Malay being a language, if you look in the Malay version of the Quran, it says Kek Allah 12 times throughout that version of the Quran. And the reason I discovered this was because I kind of had a hunch, you know, so I was looking on the Daily Stormer website and seeing all this very Islamic women hatred and, you know, all this praise Kek, Kek wills it, all that stuff. And I thought, you know, when I was learning about Islam, I saw a lot of like Allah wills it.
That's right.
Praise Allah. You know, I saw a lot of that and I thought it just sounds great. So anyway, I had a hunch and I thought, what does this word mean? And at first I thought it might mean something in Arabic and I didn't get anything back. And, to be fair, I used Google Translate and Google's kind of shady about some things and it wouldn't surprise me if maybe the translation isn't exactly correct. Mm-hmm. For this, but I use Google Translate. I'm not saying either way whether there's something going on there, but it wouldn't surprise me. In I think it was 8 or 10 different languages, kek means cake, and that kind of makes sense. Kek sounds like cake.
Right.
I thought, okay. Then I Googled Kek Allah in quotations to see what I got. And yeah, that's when I discovered that the Malay version of the Quran actually says Kek Allah. I thought it was 41 times, but it's still a dozen times throughout this Quran. And I thought, okay, I don't
what
know.
A coincidence.
That's a coincidence. So anyway, I translated it again. I translated the page using Google Translate and it translated it to God cake, which in the context of the verse makes absolutely no sense. So I thought, well, let me go to the Arabic version of the Quran and see, what does that verse say? So I can see what the meaning is supposed to be here, what the intended meaning is. And Kek Allah roughly translates to abide or abiding in God, abiding in Allah. So, yeah, just again, you know, now I'm even more nauseous when I go on to any alt-right video or something where it's the comment section is just full of this like praise kek. And I think, wow, you guys, like you may have been tricked not only into accepting Islamic values about how you treat women, but now, unbeknownst to you, you're actually praising an Islamic God.
Yeah.
Like you've been had. I'm sorry, you guys. And, you know, I just want to maybe just to be a bitch about it. A woman discovered this. Now, I thought I wasn't capable of having an original thought.
You're actually just retarded.
I'm actually just retarded and only good for making babies. So I'm sure.
Wait, no, you suck at that too.
I suck at that too, which means you should probably beat me often.
Yes, you're getting it.
Harder. Yeah. So I'm sure this is all absolute bullshit and I'm wrong and you're right. And
yeah,
this
no,
is,
totally.
You know, not Islamic at all. So, anyway.
I mean, yeah, that's very telling. And, you know, who knows who these people are on 8chan, 4chan, anonymous boards. I mean, there's so many people infiltrating pro-white forums. And, like, even in one case, luring this little girl, she's not little, she's, like, in her 20s, but she's physically tiny, to, you know, New York with promises of helping her and then raping her. And that guy was not white.
Yeah, you're talking about Roe, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, exactly. And the response... to that was particularly nauseating for me because, you know, I too have been raped in the past, and the, you know, this white woman hatred is nothing new.
No.
You know, when I told my family members that this had happened to me, everyone was very supportive except for, a couple of my cousins who are, you know, they're less attractive men. They're overweight. They sit around playing video games all day. Like, they're not.
It's your fault.
Yeah. Like, they were awful to me about it. And it was really hurtful to me. And I didn't really understand what.
They're probably MGTOWs.
Causing that. Yeah. I had no idea about MGTOW at the time. And I just thought, like, holy shit, you guys. Like, you know, I just went out with some friends of mine, to a nightclub because that's what people do in their 20s. Mm-hmm. And I just, you know, I did what my friends did because mm-hmm. I didn't want to be like by myself at home.
Right, exactly.
Like a complete social reject. So yeah, I went out with my friends and there was a guy who was like a friend of a friend. And, yeah, it just goes to show, you know, you got to be careful who you trust because he, offered to give me a ride home after like everyone else was leaving and I wanted to stay. So he's like, yeah, it's okay. Like I'll take you home after. And, he said, we just have to stop off at my place. Like I have this, I can't remember what it was he wanted to show me, but we had been talking about some art thing and he wanted to show me some drawing or something. And yeah, I was dumb enough to go up to his place and accept a glass of water.
Oh, jeez.
Right. And it's like, he was a friend of a friend, right? So it's like, but this is what people do. We trust until people give us a reason not to, because if we didn't. If we went around not trusting anyone, we would be crazy schizophrenics.
Well, you know, exactly. Like, and it's just, in a European society, we wouldn't really have to worry about accepting a glass of water that might be roofied. Like,
yeah.
That wouldn't even be, these things are not programmed into our DNA because we didn't really have to deal with these kind of things. Our men don't do that. Like,
exactly.
I mean, sure, some do, some white people do that, but it's not like ingrained in our culture.
Yeah, exactly. Which is, and I think that's another reason why I think for some of these white men, it's hard for them to understand that, that could just happen to a woman without her having some fault in the matter.
Right. Exactly. Well, they'll blame you. You know, you shouldn't gone up to his place. You should have known better. You shouldn't have accepted the drink. You shouldn't have gotten so drunk. But it's like, we shouldn't have to live in a world where we're constantly being preyed on. And this goes for boys, girls, and, you know, all sexes because, you know, like white children are preyed upon and white boys. It's just insane what goes on. So we literally are the number one target for just about everything right now.
Yeah. Yeah. And I do feel the hatred, you know, even for little things sometimes. And it's tough to be, thought of as the number one cause for why the entire nation is failing when really I'm the giver of life. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm a very special component to what makes all of this work. And you're going to try and tell me that I'm some evil, influence lurking in the shadows, you know, out to get good white men and ruin their life. Like,
oh yeah,
absolutely
totally
not. Absolutely not. You know, I love white men. Very much. And, both of my long-term relationships have been with, men of German descent just by chance. I wasn't looking for German men, but those just happened to be the men that I was attracted to. And, it was because of their qualities of
that's right. How respect. They treated you.
Yeah. They
it's
were
not
respectful.
About their money or their car. It's about, he no. treated me so nicely. He was so sweet to me. And that's funny you said that because looking back at my long-term relationships, they were all with someone with blue eyes.
Yeah.
And yeah, it wasn't like I went out. Yeah. It was just a natural attraction. It wasn't like I went out there like, I'm going to find me a blue-eyed man. You know, it's just like, oh, I really like this guy and he has blue eyes and he's Irish and wow, that's cool.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. Even before I was racially aware at all, I was going to go to Ireland. I just had this feeling of like, I just like Irish guys. It's weird. Every time I meet an Irish guy, I just feel like we get along great. Mm-hmm. There's just like an instant chemistry, not with all of them, of course, but just generally I noticed this pattern and it just felt like, you know, when I saw pictures of Ireland, I thought like, that just feels like home to me. I don't know. I was always very attracted to, European guys. Mm-hmm. And this is when I was like, totally brainwashed about all races are equal, and you know, it's not a big deal if you date someone from another race. Right. Like this is way back before I had any idea that it was dangerous for the health of the child to race mix. You know, I had no idea about that stuff yet, but I just naturally went for European men because they were intelligent, respectful, and there was an orderliness to the way that they viewed the world. You know, there was no, they could always give me a good reason for why they were doing something that I could understand and be on board with. You know, there was never any sentiment as far as, you know, him being in charge and I have to do what he says. Right. But because I respected him as a man, I naturally wanted to defer to him. You know, and anyone who's listened to the content on my channel, like, I can be a real bitch if I want to. Like, I'm not a shrinking violet in any way whatsoever. But when I'm around a real man, I can relax.
Yes.
You know, like, yes, because very feminine around real men. But if you're a little alt-right, nippy, little cunty dude, like, I'm going to put you in your place because you're trying to take me out of my place in nature, and it goes against my instincts, and I will bite you. Like, I don't want any of this Islamic or Judaic bullshit in my life. And I've always been a bad slave, you know, again, even before I had any idea about any of this stuff, I just naturally wanted to put things into correct order, and if I saw something that wasn't in place, it's like seeing a crooked picture on the wall. You know, I just couldn't help myself. I had to make it right. And I actually got fired from a job once, and I didn't know it at the time, but looking back, I realized, like, not only was my boss Jewish, but the entire board of directors was Jewish.
Oh, I bet.
And I the whole shebang was just like a big, you know,
Jew fest.
Yeah, it actually, like, I'm not gonna say what the company was, but it was controlled opposition movement. And
oh, wow.
I had no idea, you know, I got involved because I wanted to, you know, do some good in the world, but I got very frustrated very quickly because every time I tried to make a suggestion, like, well, like, we have so many resources, why aren't we doing this? And I'd always get kind of shut down. And at first I thought it was because I was a woman. You know, I thought, like, oh, maybe he's not taking me seriously because, you know, I was in my early 20s and, you know, this is like a bunch of like middle-aged Jewish guys, right? I thought that's what the problem was, but I realized now actually they saw me as a threat.
Because you're a shiksa.
I was a serious threat to them. I made noise when things weren't going as well as I thought they could be because, you know, I'm passionate about what I do and I really wanted to see us making positive change in the world. And I could tell that we were just dragging our heels and kind of just, you know, doing, lip service more than anything, and we were taking people's money and not really doing, and I felt in my heart, I felt like that was wrong. Mm-hmm. You know, like, I had a conscience about that and they didn't. And yeah, they got rid of me after about a year because I just kept questioning their approach to things. So I've always been a bad slave. And
that's good.
Yeah, now that I'm also arch negative, and I kind of wonder if...
Interesting. Yeah, not surprising.
Like, yeah, I think, I can't remember which podcast it was. Kyle had mentioned that he had noticed that too. A lot of the people who are kind of making the most noise do tend to be arch negative.
Yes.
And I think there's a lot about that blood type that we aren't told about, because if we knew about it, there would be some serious uproar in the populace. And I mean, it occurred to me one day, it's interesting that, so I can't even have a baby with, and again, I don't know if this is a lie or not, but they claim I can't have a baby with an Rh positive man without getting this injection of poison while I'm pregnant.
Yeah. The Rogam shot. I've done some research into that. Because my husband and I didn't know our blood types, and, you know, I was pregnant and we actually tested our blood and we're both Rh negative. I'm O negative. I forget. I think he's B. I don't know. I forget. But we're both Rh negative. So we luckily didn't have to even go down that route. But I've read a lot of things saying that the Rogam shot is absolutely unnecessary, because the only time there would be a problem is if there's trauma to the abdomen where the blood actually mixes, you know, where That's there's right. like internal bleeding. So honestly, I didn't look into it because I didn't like really have to, but I think there's yeah. a lot of misinformation going on around that. But think about it this way. My husband and I were naturally attracted to each other without knowing each other's blood type. And yeah. he was the one that I knew, like, I'm going to have a child with this guy. You know, I had other long-term relationships and I knew like, no, and I don't know, maybe right. their blood type was not Rh negative, but, right. I think when we are left to our own, instincts and, you know, our judgment is not clouded by all the mind viruses and the perfumes, and we can actually get each other's pheromones, right. we're just going to naturally be attracted to other Rh negative people.
Yeah. I think that's absolutely right. And even if all of that stuff is true about how, I think they say that you can have one an Rh negative mother can have one Rh positive baby, but if there's blood mixing, then
yeah.
her subsequent children will have issues. But, you know, I got to ask the question then, like if nature is then going to, result in birth defects or in, spontaneous abortions, or, basically if my body is actually going to attack the fetus, then why would I interfere with nature?
That's right. Making,
yeah, like there's a reason why that's happening. Like, why would we think we're smarter than nature right. to think that we can go in there and just, you know, inject a woman with God knows what, mercury and animal byproducts, like,
and blood, like foreign and blood products. Right.
Yeah.
Like, what is
yeah.
that doing? You know, maybe exactly. that's the overall agenda, is to inject foreign blood into these Rh negative women.
Yeah. And I can't say for sure. I am leaning in the direction of thinking that this entire thing is just a scam to, harm the unborn child so that they won't be quite so much of a threat.
Yes,
when they grow up, because if this is true, that it is Rh negative people who are the ones who are making the most noise and standing up against this foreign ruling establishment that has infiltrated our countries, of course they would do everything in their power to make sure that they nip that in the bud as soon as possible.
Oh, yeah. So, and they can predict, you know, like with their game theory and all these things, they can predict like what the outcome is going to be of certain things, you know, 100 years in advance. So I'm sure they foresee right. this awakening of this bloodline. We right. saw that kind of with like the indigo crystal children. And then they know this is coming. So that's why they've ramped up their vaccine schedule. That's why they've ramped up the number of ultrasounds. That's why they're doing everything they can to attack the gestating baby, you know, before they're yeah. like ruined before they even get a chance.
Yes. I think the rates of autism now are something like 1 in 50, where it used to be something like 1 in 300,000.
Oh, I think it's more than that, honestly. Yeah. yeah but that is the
really
official
high.
Number. You're right.
It's really, really high. And if you look at the, I think the vaccines for kids were first introduced back in the 40s, I think.
Yeah.
And every year that goes by, like if you look at the amount of the number of vaccines that the kids get, it correlates pretty much
oh, yeah.
perfectly with the rise in autism. So I don't know enough about what ingredients are causing or affecting the development of this, and even if it's reversible or not with some kind of detox
unfortunately,
method.
Unfortunately, I don't think some of it is, because when you look at what mercury does to neurons under a microscope, the neurons literally disintegrate and disappear.
Right.
Like I've seen children who have they can't speak because they have no use of the muscles in their mouth.
Right.
It's
wow.
like they're so damaged. It's just such a crime. You know, these children who otherwise would be healthy, whose parents love them, are just poisoned and ruined.
Yep. Yeah. So I do think it's all part of a plan, particularly with Rogam, because all kids yeah. get vaccines, but only Rh negative mothers get
That's
this very
right.
special vaccine.
And it's routine. And
it's routine. And not only is it routine, they get it more than once.
That's right. And with every child.
With every child. And they're pushed. Even I've heard comments just on different message forums, women saying that the father is also Rh negative, but the doctors claim like, well, we don't know if maybe you had an affair. Like they'll come up with any excuse to try to give it to the women. Even wow. if the father, they're saying like, no, I'm in a monogamous relationship. he's Rh negative. There's no issue, but they'll still say no, because we don't have any proof. Like, now they want what? Like, they want a sex tape or something. I don't know.
Like,
how are you supposed to prove that? Right. So anyway, it's really being pushed, on these women. And that's one of the main red flags for me that makes me think that it's, intended to do damage, is just how heavily it's pushed, and the guilt, you know, they say, like, you're putting your, future children's health at risk if you don't get
this.
You're
a bad mother. Do is if they refuse, they'll have the baby taken away immediately after birth. They'll be, you're an unfit mother. You can't have this baby. That's why I highly encourage everyone to stay as far away as possible from the hospital if you're giving birth. If you're a healthy woman, please research hospital births, because it is the worst place to give birth. You can have a home birth. There are many midwives that will attend. You can have an unassisted birth. I had an unassisted birth. Everything went fine. I would have done it no other way. So, you know, we're capable of doing these things as women, but we've been robbed of that, you know, that ancestral knowledge. Like, our mothers were traumatized in birth. Their mothers were traumatized in birth. It's really been like generational trauma.
Yeah. I know when my mother, gave birth to me, she had a C-section.
Same.
Yeah, and they didn't even anesthetize her fully before they went in and did it.
I hear that all the time, that they actually feel the cutting.
Yeah, yeah, like she was not fully anesthetized. So she had been so trained to just go along to get along.
Healthy baby.
So, yeah, you know,
should be happy.
So she didn't, as traumatizing as this was for her, she still, you know, she thought, well, you know, it had to be done for the best interest of it. And, you know, she just still
alive, you know?
She justified it.
It
really didn't need to be done. And, and my mother is this beautiful, blonde, blue eyed Swedish woman. And, you know, I think, like, just how I know, looking back on some of my encounters with doctors who in retrospect were obviously, Jewish women, mean they've been to me.
They're very jealous.
Like very sadistic in the way that they've treated me when I've gone for medical care in the past. And, you know, it's disturbing to think about. Like, so this beautiful blonde blue-eyed Swedish woman comes in to have a baby, and then they don't anesthetize her fully. Like, what the fuck is that about? You're absolutely right. It's been stolen from women, this tradition of having children in the home, you know, in a safe environment, you know, even in the wild. Animals, when they're ready to give birth, they naturally go hide themselves.
That's right.
It's not normal to be like on a gurney with
your legs,
doctors all around and
like
light.
A spotlight on you.
Yeah,
like, it's spotlight like spotlight on your vagina. Here we go, everybody. Let's watch the show. It's like, what? Anybody would freeze up.
Anybody would. Yeah, and my sister had issues giving birth in the hospital, and, you know, I was not surprised at all. But she's actually married to a doctor.
It's so conditioned into our brains. As little girls, we grow up seeing movies where women are like, like flipping out, like they're possessed while they're giving birth, and they're like, "Fuck you!" to their husbands.
Yep. Excellent point. Yeah.
Yeah. So we grow up thinking, oh God, I remember thinking as a girl, why the hell would anybody want to have a baby? This is so why would anybody want to go through that?
Exactly.
They get us, you know, motherhood is made to look so awful. It's painful. It's just the worst thing ever. And we're conditioned to think that. And that's why when we anticipate fear and pain, it's going to happen. I know when I actually experienced pain in my labor, it's because I was getting scared and my muscles started to tense up. But before that, I was in my own little world, and each contraction or wave of pressure was like, I could handle it. It was manageable. But when I started to get afraid, that's when it was bad. It got painful.
Yes. Well, they tried to tell my sister she had, get this, an incompetent cervix.
Oh, yeah. They loved the little fancy terms. Your vagina didn't work properly. No.
Yeah. God made your vagina wrong. So we're going to fix it for you.
You're stupid.
Yeah. Incompetent. Your cervix is retarded. If that doesn't just, you know, scream insanity, I don't know what does. Yeah, it's,
and they time it's, them. You've been laboring for 4 hours. We need to get that baby out. What?
Yeah.
I don't even feel the contractions yet. Well, we're gonna have to induce you. No, I don't want that. Yeah. Okay, well then your baby's gonna be taken away. It's like what? You're literally processed when you get there. Like you have no rights. The minute you walk into the hospital, you have signed your rights away, and your baby can be taken away at any moment. I'm not saying that if there's an emergency, not to go, but
of course, of course. But yeah, it's really. I mean, I don't want to use the word rape, but it's very rape-like the way that they treat you as like a subhuman thing.
Well, it is processing, rape. I mean, they, like, right? Yeah, they insert their hands into the woman's vagina several times and she cannot say no. When I was a doula for one birth and I walked in and this was a hospital birth and the nurse or whoever it was had her fingers up my client's vagina and she's screaming, help me. I was like, what the hell did I just walk into?
Holy shit.
Yeah. And then they were threatening to take this woman's other child away because the father never showed up. And it was just like the worst experience I've ever had. And that's when I was done going to hospitals for, I said, I will never attend another hospital birth. This was the most traumatic thing I've ever experienced. And I wasn't even the laboring woman.
Yeah. Well, it is traumatizing to see, you know, when we, even if we're just watching like sports or something like of people playing soccer, like we have mirror neurons in our brain that match what's happening. And especially like when you're a woman and you see another woman in such a compromising position and she's being treated like an animal, it does something to you to witness that too.
Yeah.
And when my sister-in-law gave birth, she had, similar thing. They said like, it's not going fast enough. They induced her. And I think that just caused more problems. I mean, she suffered horribly.
And then what a great way to start off parenting. Like you're traumatized and you don't even like, you can't sleep. That's why women go into postpartum depression and end up killing themselves.
Yeah.
It's so common. Yeah. I mean, I even experienced like what they call the baby blues just because my hormones were all over the place. And I felt so crazy in the first couple of days. I was just crying randomly, like, but I was happy. Yeah. And so it's like an emotional roller coaster. So I had a very good birth experience and I still struggled as a new mom. So I cannot imagine being raped at the hands of these doctors, having your vagina cut open. You know, and being tortured and then being like, here's your baby. Have fun. Oh, and we just gave him a bunch of vaccines and now he's going to scream for 24 hours straight. Have fun.
Yep. Yeah. It's absolutely disgusting.
Yeah.
And I know that, you know, when women are pregnant too, you know, nature decrees it so that, you know, because you're building a life inside of your own body, as many resources as possible are, rooted towards the fetus so that you can grow a healthy baby. And our bodies, I think I dropped my microphone. Our bodies naturally, I think we have a greater ability to have resilience against, stress while we're pregnant.
Yes.
Just so that, we can give birth to healthy babies. But once that baby is out of your body, it can really catch up with you pretty quickly. And if you've had a traumatic birth experience, so you've got 9 months of time where, you know, any amount of stress that might have been weighing on you is kind of just, it's like it's waiting in a queue.
Yeah.
For you, right? It's queued up for you to deal with when the baby is out of your body. Because
that's
a great point. Yeah. Yeah. For now, baby's growing. It's the most important thing. Mm-hmm. You know, the arguments you're having with your husband or, you know, whatever else might be happening in your life with your work or that all gets kind of put on a back burner until the baby's out of your body, because you don't want to, you know, if you're putting that kind of stress on a fetus, because, you know, the stress hormones get in your bloodstream, right? That will not go right to the fetus, but I'm sure it affects.
Oh, yeah.
It affects the baby somehow to have mother under a great level of stress that will affect the health.
Higher cortisol levels in the baby.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, it's a developing brain, a developing child. Your body naturally guards against too much stress when you're pregnant, but it's not that it goes away. It just kind of cues up. Right. Oh, and then if you have a traumatic birth after that,
support system either. I realized that I never felt more lonely than after my son was born and after I was pregnant, because I had no community. I was very fortunate to have a husband that works from home. He was amazing. Mm-hmm. We took shifts, you know, we made sure we were amazing team. We made sure you got your 5 hours of sleep. I got my 5 hours of sleep. Okay. Yep. Let's go. It wasn't easy, but these women where they have nobody,
Like, yes. Nobody around. Their husband goes back to work. They, you know, a lot of cases, these women are so sore, they can't even go to the bathroom. It's painful to urinate. It's painful to get up to even hold the baby to nurse them because they have a big C-section scar. I mean, this is just so traumatic. And it moves me to tears just even thinking about it. Like, all these families that are so traumatized from the start. Yeah. And then that's the foundation that you build your family unit off of. No wonder this world is in such a sorry state.
Yeah. Yeah. And then you hear the stories where the women, you know, they have a home birth and it's natural. And I was shocked to even learn that there's such a thing as orgasmic birth. I had no idea that that even existed. And I randomly came across some testimonials on YouTube, some women talking about that. And they can testify that to have such, and not even that they had to have, you know, you don't have to have an orgasm when you give birth, but just to have your baby in a safe environment around your loved ones. Mm-hmm. And, you know, again, without like a giant fluorescent spotlight on your vagina while you're giving birth, like, you know, doctors and clipboards and, you know, little electronic devices. You're all hooked up. Like, yeah, all these little beeping noises. Like, you know, when you can actually give birth in a loving and safe environment like that, there's really no better. Because the bonding, it starts when the child is growing inside you, but there's a shift that happens when the baby is born, a chemical shift that is very, very important for bonding, and that gets disrupted.
Absolutely.
In a hospital, especially when, you know, you have a home birth, as soon as the baby is out, you can pick the baby up and hold it to your chest.
Skin contact immediately, which is
immediately
so important, and eye contact. And they do everything to get in the way of that at the hospital. They immediately cut the umbilical cord, which the baby asphyxiates because they haven't received all the oxygen from the placenta. Yeah. They give the woman a shot of Pitocin, which you know, basically ejects the placenta immediately instead of letting it naturally detach. And then Pitocin will often give very painful contractions. So the woman's in pain with, you know, like post-labor pain contractions. Her baby's over there having silver nitrate cream rubbed in its eyes. So the skin, the eyes are blurry. They can't make eye contact. They put a hat on and they swaddle them so that they can't have skin to skin and there's no smell. I took my son. He was covered in poop. I didn't care. I took him. I kissed. I instinctively sucked the amniotic fluid out of his nose and mouth because, I mean, he was breathing. He was staring right at me as he came out, and I caught him myself.
Amazing.
And I brought him up, and I saw that he had some kind of fluid in his nose, and I just instinctively sucked it out, spit it out, and I just held him right to my chest and was like, holy crap. I can't believe I just did this.
Wow, that's absolutely beautiful. And that's how it should be. That's how nature decreed it to be. And it's true. They do get in the way of every single aspect of bonding in the hospital.
And it's by no accident.
No, I do believe it's all by design. You know, I used to think it was just like, well, they're just trying to process as many people as quickly as possible. Like, okay, come on. There's really no reason why they have to do it all like that quickly, because usually you're just kind of hanging out recovering for a little while anyways. I mean, come on. Like, they're not that busy that they have to do all of these different things in a way that is maximizing the trauma to both you and your child. Like, it's absolutely ridiculous. There's no excuse for it.
No, there really isn't.
Yeah, I want to get back on the topic though about this domesticating men, though, if we can.
Let's touch on that before we go. I do have to leave in a few minutes, but I do want to touch on that before we end the call for sure.
So when I was, I've only been GY since August, if you can believe it. This is all like new for me, but it all kind of fell into place in a way that just sort of made, the world finally makes sense as far as why things were being done in the way that they were being done. Cause like I said before, I've always been a bad slave and I've always been attempting to rectify things that seemed out of place for me. And I tell you, it gets me nothing but trouble in a world where things are meant to be out of place. You know, I fix the crooked picture and then immediately someone's like, nope, that's, you know, they try to give me. And I just said, that's not a good reason at all. Like, that's absolutely retarded. But I always wondered, like, what is it about, like, our young men these days and this idea of, you hear it all the time. They say, like, well, we have to help at-risk boys. You know, they're at risk for violence and they're at risk for, you know, all these mental conditions like ADD are supposedly like really common in young boys. You know, and I'm thinking they're just at this point medicalizing the normalcy of
pathologizing like normal behavior.
Yeah, I mean, yes, young boys are boisterous. They're loud.
Oh, yes.
They're larger than life. They, you know, they're just, they can bounce off the walls in a way that, you know, as a young girl, I remember noting, so, you know, that would have been back in the 80s when I was growing up. I remember just noting how rambunctious the boys were compared to me. And that's why I didn't, you know, obviously I didn't play with little boys in the same way that like I would play with girls. Like if I played with boys, it's because we were playing kickball or sports, right? But you know, with girls, we were more interested in like, you know, our dolls and, you know, sort of
playing
everyone
house.
Gets along, play house, everyone like is like with women, I think we want everyone to sort of be like
cooperate
and, you know, equality is more important in terms of like a circle of women. Whereas with men, it's really important for them to test each other and see, like, where do I fit on this hierarchy of men? Because it's very natural for them to do so. In fact, they need to know where they fit in that hierarchy so that they know which is their leader that they're going to look to. And it's really bothering me, all this talk about, like, oh, you're a beta cuck. You're a beta. You know what a beta is? You know, there can only really be one alpha, depending on the context, of course. But if you have a single context, like the home environment or the work environment or like an army brigade, you know, of course, a guy comes home and he's the alpha of his family. Like in that way, every man who has a family is an alpha. But, you know, in the workplace or in any other context in his society, he may find himself in the position of a beta. And it's important to understand that a beta is not a bad thing.
Yeah.
You know, we need men in certain contexts to take that beta role because not everyone can lead. You know, we let the best man lead depending on the context.
That's right.
So, imagine if you had an army full of alpha males, what do you think would happen?
They would all kill each other.
They'd all kill each other. Like, or absolutely nothing would happen. They'd all be too busy, you know.
Like arguing
with each other, like nothing would get done. You know, you need a leader who's going to take everyone in a single cohesive direction so that things can get done. It's very practical and useful for men to be in a beta position. And just like white knight has been used as a slur against men who are acting like men, I believe the word beta has also been demoted to take on the meaning that actually used to be ascribed to the Omega, the untouchable. You know, there are those men, and I'm sure also women in our society, and they're usually few in number, but they are the ones who are, you know, antisocial. They don't act in ways in accordance to what's good for the group. Mm-hmm. You know, these are the ones that are the Omegas. They are the untouchables, and they're rightly so, I think, worthy of, you know, some degree of denigration for their antisocial behavior because they're doing things that are not in the interest of the group. And I do believe the word beta has been hijacked to mean, exactly that, like something bad. And it really isn't. Right. So, yeah, just like the white knight and the beta, they could say beta cuck. But, you know, if we look at the actual definition of what a beta is in terms of the social hierarchy of men, he's not a cuck. Quite the opposite. In fact, he's probably the alpha when he goes home to his wife. It's just that in the workplace, he probably has a boss who is the guy who's laying out the master plan for what, you know, what are we trying to achieve here? And if he's not cooperating with the alpha and the other beta males, nothing's going to get done. And he's probably going to end up being ostracized. So, you know, I think these words have been hijacked to limit the aggression in white males and turn them into something that is lesser than what their potential could be. And if you, there was a website I came across back in August or September, because I was looking at some of the DNA evidence and some of the archaeological evidence for, you know, white people's history, because the history we've been told is certainly not the real history of the world. And, you know, white people were on every single continent, and it's absolutely mind blowing when you actually look into the research. But one of the channels I came across, and I kind of trolled it a little bit too, but it's called CARTA, C-A-R-T-A. And they have a lot of different presentations on archaeology and human biology and human psychobiology, all these different things. And a lot of the presenters are Jewish. So, you know, I didn't notice that right away, but I finally caught on that, you know, what they're talking about here isn't just applicable to animals. There was a guy who gave a presentation, and I had a video I put up yesterday about To Men With Love. And there's some links in the comments section there to, it takes you right to the exact minute and second point where it actually discusses the points about how you would domesticate an animal, if you wanted to, say, take a wolf to a chihuahua. Like, how would you do that over generations? And the way you do that is to reward behavior that limits aggression.
Yep.
And not only that, you also increase the serotonin levels. So, what do we see happening pretty commonly now is things like SSRI drugs, the antidepressant drugs, which will increase the serotonin levels in people. And I mean, I don't think it's abnormal for someone to be depressed living in a society such as ours. You know, like, I think if you're not depressed, there's probably something wrong with you.
Yes.
That's just my opinion, but like it's no sign of health to be well adjusted to a sick society. Mm-hmm. And if you're depressed, it's for a good reason. It's not because your serotonin levels are too low. It's because your society is sick. But this lie has been pushed that higher serotonin levels are better.
Yeah, or that you have a chemical imbalance, even though that's never been proven.
Yeah, then there's literally no, even if that were true, there's no test that they can give you to prove that you in fact have a chemical imbalance. But I mean, the fact remains these drugs increase your serotonin levels. And what happens, again, when you increase your serotonin is that you're less likely to react to external threats of aggression. Mm-hmm. So not only have you been rewarded all your life for behaviors that limit your aggression, but you're possibly also taking antidepressants or even marijuana use can increase your serotonin levels. And this can all be reversed if you remove the offender, antidepressant drug that's causing your serotonin levels to rise. But you have to be aware that there's a problem first. You know, and just add all that on to, just the estrogen mimicking chemicals that are lacing food and water everywhere. And the fact that, you know, women are all taking birth control, peeing into the water supply, and then that just gets recycled and recycled. And, you know, our food and our water are really, really, you know, unless you're taking precautions to protect yourself as a man, the chances are your estrogen levels are, even if your testosterone levels are normal, the ratio of your testosterone to estrogen is going to be off because of all the estrogen in the environment. And a lot of men, it didn't used to be this way, but they have like swollen nipples.
Yeah.
From just environmental estrogen.
Oh yeah. Even, I mean, I've seen, I think it's called gynecomastia or something like, males with bigger boobs than, you know, women. It's a lot of that has to do too with the psychotropics that they're on. A lot of those, like Risperdal was one, I think it was an antipsychotic that was causing a lot of these, you know, young boys to grow boobs. And again, these medications too are completely messing with their brain development, their hormonal development. And a lot of boys and girls, well, I'd say it happens to girls more, but they're being pushed into puberty way too early. And it's kind of like when you plant something, a flower that flowers too soon. I had that happen here. I planted my sunflowers way too soon and they came up, but they're all stunted and they're all like deformed. And that's like when you blossom too early, when you sexually mature these people way too early. But I hate to cut this short, but I have to run.
Oh, it's all good. It's all good. You know, we'll do this again sometime.
Yes.
You know, there's so many different topics that I think we could get into that would be, you know, interesting just to, share each other's thoughts about, because yeah, I mean, I've done so much research the last little while. It's, I've got so many notes. So yeah, we could definitely do this again anytime you're free.
Definitely. And if you ever want to take your notes and say, do your own, you know, like podcast, and you want to air it on Renegade Broadcasting or my channel or anywhere, please feel free to send it to me. Or if you want to do a wild card show on Renegade, you know, and if you know, don't want to do it alone, you want to bring a partner, people would really love to hear from you. You have so much knowledge, and, it was really, really nice getting to talk to you.
It was so great to finally talk to you too. Yeah. And just, I mean, just to show that we're two different women also. I think they were some of these trolls. You know, they really thought it was you. It's like,
it's hilarious. Everybody that says something that like, I maybe agree with, it might not even be 100%. They're like, okay, Sinead, I'm just, right. I guess I'm like 5 million different people.
I know. I said I was a Sinead 6 million. There's 6 million of you out there, and
I've a clone.
You've got 6 million accounts that you're running, and you're raising a family at the same time. She's absolutely, you know, she's superwoman, right? So, yeah, I know it's been an absolute pleasure getting to talk to you, and I would be honored if I could send you guys some content, because I do have a number of different interest areas I've been heavily researching over the years, again, just because I've been a bad slave and I know like things don't seem quite right, and I've been trying to get to the bottom of a lot of different things that just kind of were irking me and rubbing me the wrong way. So yeah, I've definitely got lots more to talk about. So yeah, I'd be honored to be back on to talk with you anytime, or to send you guys some content.
Wonderful. Well, I can't wait to hear more from you. Can you tell our listeners the name of your YouTube channel and where they can check out your work?
Yep. My YouTube channel is $6 million gas bill. I believe I'm the only one, and, they've already given me one strike for hate speech, something that I literally just re-uploaded something that I found off of YouTube a few months ago. And anyway, it's there for now. I'll do another channel if it gets taken down at some point, but yeah, you can find me there for now. I've got a couple of new videos that I put up in the last few days. So, yeah, go check it out. And, I look forward to hearing from you guys in the comments about what you think about everything that we talked about today, because we certainly did cover a lot of ground.
Oh,
so,
yes, we've covered a lot.
Yeah.
There'll be a very interesting comment section.
Oh, and I think I sent you the link to the Malay Quran, if you wouldn't mind, or I could send it to you again. I think we should put that maybe in the yes. video description, so people can go see it with their own two eyes. You know, I think it's important just so they know we're not making it up. It's
right,
there,
exactly.
And it says Kek Allah. So yeah, I think we'll close with that. And yeah, I look forward to talking with you again soon.
All right, Six. Thank you very much, and I'll be in touch.
Okay, you're most welcome. I'll
Bye.
Talk to you later.
Later.
All right, so I wanted to go more into depth on this TMOC study that I briefly touched on when I came on to Kyle's show on Sunday. And it's interesting because we have, you know, Comet, and the reverse of Comet is TMOC. So this study, I misspoke. The study is not called TMOC. It's this coping strategy that they have given the acronym of TMOC, and I'll get into what that stands for, but I'll just read from the abstract of the study, and I'll give you the title. You can find it on PubMed. A qualitative study of childhood sexual abuse survivors in Taiwan toward a transactional and ecological model of coping. In this study, we aimed to explore the experiences of 10 female Taiwanese childhood sexual abuse survivors, age range 20 to 39 years, to broaden our understanding of the post-abuse coping process in a Chinese sociocultural context. This investigation was grounded on a feminist paradigm, and the consensual qualitative research method was utilized as the strategy of inquiry. The transactional and ecological model of coping that emerged from the data describes the dynamic interplay among A, interpersonal, and sociocultural factors, and B, the coping process and outcomes of CSA, childhood sexual abuse, survivors. Implications for research on CSA recovery and culturally appropriate interventions in a collectivistic sociocultural context are discussed. Okay. Now, they get into transactional and ecological model of coping, TMOC. So, they basically, it's one, two, three. It's like three layers of a circle. In the middle, there's the self. And they have coping strategies, coping outcomes, problem appraisal, psychological adjustment, CSA stress. Then they have the relational context, which is the family, perpetrator, romantic partners, others, friends, and the sociocultural context, which is norms, values, customs, and sociopolitical history. Okay, here's some more on TMOC. A transactional and ecological model of coping was developed to depict the bidirectional relations among the interplay of clusters and domains found in our study. More specifically, the model illustrates the interplay among variables embedded or nested within an ecological system depicting the self, relational context, and sociocultural context. Below, we provide a narrative summary that illustrates how the TMOC represents the transactional nature of the data and the reciprocal relationships between various components of the model. Please note this narrative does not describe any one individual case, and thus confidentiality and anonymity of the participants was ensured, yet it offers a vivid description of a typical CSA survivor's story. I'm not going to get into the narrative summary of, you know, their subjects. You can go check it out if you want, but I just thought that was kind of interesting that they're, you know, TMOC is this coping strategy for childhood sexual abuse. Now, I want to correct something that I stated on Kyle's show. I did say that I was not quite sure because we have so many messages come in and we're so busy. But so James Elefantis' grandmother has a business. It's actually, okay, so Elefantis and Associates have, you know, they're listed on Elm Street, 6862 Elm Street, McLean, Virginia, which is interesting, just an interesting choice of name. You have Nightmare on Elm Street, the Elm House in the UK, which was a huge child sex slavery house that I guess was, it was busted. So just kind of interesting. I don't think that's by chance. I think they pick these things for a reason. So now I'm going to switch over to a new topic, and I'm going to read from an article here that is called Mommy, Does God Hate Women? It's actually really interesting, and it shows why I despise Christianity, and, well, you should too. Okay. This simple yet profoundly insightful question was posed by my neighbor's 6-year-old daughter, Jillian. It was inspired by her 12-year-old sister, Sarah's recent emergence into womanhood, i.e. the onset of her first menses. Rather than try to put a positive spin on this life-changing and often traumatic event in a young woman's life, their mother, an evangelical Christian, explained to the girls that this was the curse that great Jehovah put upon Eve for her disobedience in the Garden of Eden. Wow, that's great. Let's teach our daughters that they're being cursed. That's wonderful. I nearly choked on my cucumber sandwich when I heard her say that. Does anyone even use the term the curse anymore, I wondered? Apparently some evangelical Christians do. And in doing so, they continue to burden their daughters with the same guilt, shame, and degradation that for thousands of years have kept women subjugated by the specious dictates of an ectoplasmic tyrant with some serious misogynist issues. And all this because the transgression of one woman with a fruit fetish, a woman who never existed in the first place. Sounds totally mentally sane. Really, it sounds really healthy. Okay. I was deeply saddened and disturbed by what I'd heard that day, but I knew better than to argue with a brainwashed, brain-dead evangelical. So with little Jillian's question still burning through my mind, I decided to do my own research. With a King James Version Bible in one hand and a copy of the Bible Handbook published by American Atheist Press in the other, I set out to see if I could find any evidence to support or disclaim the hypothesis, "Does God hate women?" My first quest was to find out if the curse literally was a curse, as we've all learned from National Geographic and PBS. The treatment of women and women's issues in general seems to vary greatly from one culture to another. They range from the innocuous to the grisly. But since I, like Jillian and Sarah, was raised in a middle-class Anglo-American Christian household, I will limit my experiences and observations to the socio-religious paradigm. In addition to the research materials previously mentioned, I have also found an excellent internet site that allows you to search the Bible by verse or individual word. It's BibleStudyTools.com. Further, you can compare various interpretations to see how biblical verbiage has been tweaked over the centuries, sometimes creating vastly conflicting and even contradictory meanings. No surprise to an atheist. And while I did not find anything that referred to a woman's menstrual cycle as being the result of a curse per se, I did find numerous shocking and even downright gruesome passages pertaining to the treatment of women in general. For brevity's sake, I will not quote entire passages in this article. Instead, I will synopsize the main points with the KJV verses and chapter, along with page numbers where references can be found in the Bible handbook. While not specifically referred to as a curse, a woman's monthly cycle is repeatedly called a sickness. Furthermore, during this time, she is considered unclean, similar to the disease-riddled lepers of biblical time. This uncleanness is so odious, in fact, that if a husband should have intercourse with his wife during this time, both of them will be put to death. Oh my God, this is so stupid. Okay. Numerous other references abound regarding the many asinine restrictions and punishments placed on women in this unholy psychological state. Oh, sorry, physiological state. Even the so-called miracle of childbirth carries with it an unsavory stigma. According to Leviticus 12, verses 1 through 8, TBH page 72 to 73, if a woman gives birth to a son, she is considered unclean for 7 days. However, if she gives birth to a daughter, she is unclean for 2 weeks. How could giving birth to a precious baby girl make a woman twice as unclean? The passage goes on to say that the mother must then atone for this filthy sin by paying various forms of tribute to the priest. This is so friggin' gay. Generally speaking, the social status of women in the Bible is on par with the average farm animal. Sounds like the alt-right! For instance, Deuteronomy 22, verses 20 through 21, tells us that a girl who has lost her virginity, reason not specified, should be dragged into the street and stoned to death by the men of the city. An even more heinous punishment for a similar crime was prescribed to the daughter of the priest, Leviticus 21, verse 9, she shall be burnt with fire. So much for a good love, compassion, and forgiveness. But perhaps the most culturally reprehensible and longest enduring curse against women comes from Exodus 22:8. Thou shalt not suffer a witch to live. How many thousands of innocent women have been gruesomely tortured and murdered in the name of this hate-inspired commandment? Throughout the Bible, evil cities are always referred to in the feminine sense, whoredom, harlot, adulteress. One such city, Samaria, pissed off the big guy so badly that he declared, "They shall fall by the sword, their infants shall be dashed in pieces, and their women with child shall be ripped up." Aww, that was Hosea 13:16. Cute. Perhaps the two most degrading and downright sickening stories that illustrate Jehovah's contemptuous attitude toward women are found in Genesis 19:8 and Judges 19, verses 21 through 30. The first is the famous story of Lot in the town of Sodom. Rather than hand over his magical angel buddies to the Sodomites, for they would do wickedly unto them, this holy man of God offers instead to throw his two virgin daughters into their midst, telling the rapacious horde, "Do ye to them as is good in your eyes, only unto these men do nothing." Sweet, sounds like a good dad. Totally cool. The second story is so vile, so repulsive, that most faint-hearted Christians, when I relate it to them, gasp wide-eyed and exclaim, "There is no such story in the Bible! Oh, no way, it couldn't be." Oh, but there is. It begins with the Levite... sounds pretty Jewy, a priest traveling with his concubine, apparently a must-have for every righteous man of God. They stop at the house of an old man. Soon, a sex-crazed mob besieges the house, demanding to have their way with the Levite. Sound familiar? Like any good biblical father, the old man instead offers up his virgin daughters and the concubine to be ravaged, saying to the assailants, "Humble ye them, and do with them what seemeth good unto you." At this point, the priest, obviously to protect himself, tosses his hapless concubine out the door. She is summarily beaten and gang-raped all through the night. In the morning, she drags herself, mortally injured, back to her lord and dies on his doorstep. Aww,
That's really healthy. That uplifts our people so much. This is great. Totally awesome. Rather than express grief or horror at her grisly demise, the Levite simply hacks her already mutilated corpse into 12 pieces and ships them to the 12 tribes of Israel. That's great. In response to this ghastly fairy tale, one must ask, why would a loving God condone such depravity? Excuse my stuffy nose. I have yet to find a Christian or Jew who can tell me what the moral lesson of this outrageous fable is. Okay, the atrocities committed against women and children in the Bible are too numerous to recount and difficult to stomach. Many involve glorious acts of warfare in which the chosen people preemptively attack, slaughter, pillage, rape, and burn, all at the behest of their one true God. One shining example of this holy massacre takes place in Numbers 31, verses 7 through 35. Moses, one of the main superheroes in Christian mythology, is personally directed by Jehovah to slay the Midianite men and take the women captive. Now, says Moses to his bloodthirsty marauders, kill every male among the little ones, and kill every woman that hath known man by lying with him. But all the women children that have not known a man by lying with him, keep alive for yourselves. Note, virgin girls along with livestock are specifically referred to as prey and booty. Words fail to describe this level of depravity exemplified by these and many other verses in the purported good book. Personally, I hold the Bible to be little more than a puerile collection of superstitious folktales and plagiarized mythology with a smattering of grossly inaccurate history punctuated throughout by derivative philosophy. However, it is easy to believe that the aforementioned stories, horrific though they may be, are quite authentic. We have only to examine the very real modern-day atrocities being committed against women in Africa, Asia, and the Middle East to see what faith-blinded theocrats are capable of. So to answer the question, does God hate women? Scriptural evidence does in fact demonstrate an almost psychotic prejudice and divine contempt for the female of our species. Have women therefore been cursed? To paraphrase my evangelical neighbor, yes. However, the curse is no mere biological event. The true curse placed upon women down through the centuries can be summed up in a single word, religion. And only by exposing these despicable stories can we hope to free our daughters from this odious spell forever. And I'll add daughters and sons, because this is not healthy for boys or girls. So now we're going to switch over to this really weird article that someone sent me, and it just shows again how neurotic and psychopathic and weird these Abrahamic religions are. And okay, we're gonna get into this one here. It's called "I Had to Take My Dirty Panties to a Rabbi, and So Has Every Orthodox Jewish Woman." Religion brainwashed me into doing irrational and emotionally self-damaging things that I would have easily recognized as primitive and harmful were it not for my indoctrination. Of all the practices I look back on with horror, this was the worst. By removing the veil of secrecy that keeps these practices from public knowledge, my hope is that women suffering within these communities will feel empowered to leave. There are three key tenets of Orthodox Judaism, each associated with an array of laws that must be strictly adhered to. Of the three, people are generally familiar with two, the special dietary laws referred to as kosher, and the rabbinical laws of the Sabbath or Shabbat that govern the do's and don'ts during the day of rest between sundown Friday and sundown Saturday. The third pillar of Orthodox Judaism, family purity or nida, is one very few people outside of that insular world are aware of. However, if broken, the laws accompanying it carry a far greater penalty in the next world than those related to the Sabbath or keeping kosher. The laws of family purity apply to all spectrums of orthodoxy, including the modern ones that allow women to wear trousers and uncover their hair, like the sect Ivanka Trump belongs to, for example. Even the slightest deviation from these laws would compromise a couple's standing as practicing Orthodox Jews in the eyes of a rabbinical court. What are these laws, you ask? The laws of family purity revolve around the color of a woman's vaginal discharge.
So already this is retarded. Okay, here we go. You see, beginning on the days when she anticipates her period, a husband and wife are forbidden from having any sexual relations until 7 days following the end of her period. Considering Orthodox law states that a period's duration is a minimum of 5 days, this typically spans about 2 weeks or longer, depending on whether her postmenstrual discharge cooperates. In short, this means that for about half of the month, all aspects of an Orthodox woman's life, relationships, sexuality, and emotional health are dictated by her vaginal discharge. What the hell? Except for the far-left minority, most Orthodox sects go even further with their adherence to the ancient laws by completely prohibiting any physical contact. Couples may not sleep in the same bed or even hand objects to each other directly, even a baby. They can't pass their own children back and forth. All to prevent the increase of temptation to have sexual contact. Because, yeah, they're going to totally die if they have sex while she's on her period. They're just going to explode and blow up into pieces. Because, yeah, gay is going to strike them with lightning. These laws apply even after a miscarriage, during childbirth, months following childbirth, and even if a spouse loses a family member and needs a hug from their partner. You cannot be touched. Your husband can't even touch you while you're giving birth. This is so psychotic. While the woman is required to count 7 clean days before she may immerse herself in a ritual bath, a mikveh, prior to reuniting with her husband, it's not only a matter of days of time waiting. The woman must take an active role to ensure she is clean by wearing only white underwear and conducting self-examinations of her vaginal canal with special white cloths twice a day, every day, before sundown. This is so crazy. The white cloth is inserted into the vagina so that any fluid or discharge is absorbed. The first examination of the 7 days requires the cloth to be left in for any fluid or discharge is absorbed. The first examination of 7 days requires the cloth to be left in about an hour, even if the woman is out of the house, and it's usually quite painful. Here's an excerpt from a website detailing very specific examination instructions. We're going to skip over that. I don't even want to know. Okay. This is disgusting. Okay, I'll read this just because this is what they're teaching. I won't read the descriptions, but I'll read this little quote they have here. Insert the finger deeply but gently into the vaginal canal as far as the length of your finger will allow. If this is difficult for you, try to go deeply at least for the Hefsek Tarara first examination and for one of the examinations during the 7 blood-free days, preferably the first. This is insane. If during the 7 days any of the examination cloths contain even a tiny spot darker than tan or a spot on here, underwear bigger than a penny and darker than tan, she must take the underwear or cloth to a special rabbi for further evaluation. This rabbi will then examine the color to determine if it is light enough for her to keep counting or if it's too dark or too red tinted, such that she must begin counting the 7 clean days over, even if it is day 7. Seeing a spot obviously induces massive anxiety for housewives longing for any affection from their husbands, many of whom also worry that their deprived husbands will start looking elsewhere. Like little boys. Question, how do boys and girls raised in a culture obsessed with modesty accept this practice when they are made aware of what they must adhere to? Answer, one, they are told that these special rabbis are like male OBGYNs, and that there is nothing sexual about them examining the discharge, and that if someone still thinks it's inappropriate, it's because they have a dirty mind and do not understand the holiness that motivates these rabbis. Two, engaged couples are told that if husbands sleep with their wives too much, they will grow tired of them, the way a person's love of chocolate cake would dwindle if eaten for every meal. The girls are also told, without a forced physical separation, their husbands will only see them as a sexual toy and will have no incentive to talk to them and connect on a deeper emotional and intellectual level. Three, to paraphrase what Sam Harris has said, one guy cutting off a girl's clitoris is called a monster. Hundreds of men doing the same is called culture. Why can't women check the colors themselves? Well, it's because they're fucking retarded. That's why. Answer, according to Jewish law, women can't be judges and can't make legal rulings, okay? So this is why they need to send their underwear to a rabbi. It makes sense. I get it now.
Okay, it goes on. Once vaginal discharge is darker than a tan, a legal judgment is required. A legal judgment about your frickin' underwear. This is just ridiculous. This parasitic mind virus needs to be mocked and scorned until it's gone. This is absolutely retarded. I mean, if most people knew about this, and I'm going to get to a clip later where it's the Tyra Banks show, and this was scenic woman is like talking about it, and everyone in the audience just looks like, what the hell? This is so weird. And these are like depraved people already. So if they think this is weird, we've got the truth on our side here. This is sick. Okay. However, the minority left-leaning sect has in recent years certified some women to make these judgments. Oh my God. Whoa. So you just take it to a female rabbi, which probably looks a lot like that fat dyke that we got in a fight with a couple weeks ago. Maybe that dyke that, was yelling at us about not getting her food. Maybe she's a rabbi. I could see that. But the center and right-leaning majority, however, do not recognize their certification because they are female judges for all intents and purposes. That's wrong. Yeah, women encouraging other women and their daughters to painfully violate themselves for God instead of listening to their bodies and protecting themselves is totally normal. Further, these are the least extreme of the bunch. More here. Should we even look into this more? I'm scared. Okay, this is just insane, all right? I'm just going to read a little bit from this so you can see how insane these people are. So, the Bedika cloth and Bedikot is a self-performed internal examination. Okay, so now, listen to this. Okay, while a Bedikot can be done with other items, they are less preferable. Surgical cotton or cotton balls often contain small colored threads, which can be mistaken for stains. Furthermore, cotton absorbs blood deeply so that a genuine stain may not be visible on the surface. Oh my gosh, don't use cotton because you might still be bleeding, but we might not see it. Therefore, we're all going to die. Because that's logical. Yeah, these Jews are so damn logical. Wow. Totally not psychotic. Okay, now I'm going to play this clip of this Jewish woman who, by the way, if you don't know this, Orthodox Jewish women have to, like, shave their head and wear a wig. It's really creepy after they get married. Okay, we're going to listen to this clip, and it's really weird.
Have an interesting period tradition. What is your tradition?
Hi, Tara.
Hi.
I'm a Hasidic Orthodox Jew, and in our culture, married women separate from our spouses. We don't move out of the house. We live in the same house, but we separate physically from our spouse for the duration of our period. And then once the period's over, we do an exam to make sure that the period stopped.
How do you do the exam to make sure it stops?
You use a white cloth, a cotton white cloth, very specified type of absorbent fabric. You do insert it internally to check that your period actually stopped. And you kind of get rid of the residual bleeding that way. And then you start counting what are called the 7 white days, where you wear white undergarments. And then for 7 days, you do an exam as well, just to make sure that there's no bleeding. And once the 7 days are over, we go to this place called the mikveh. It's a facility that every Jewish community has and prioritizes in their community. It has basically, they're spa-like and beautiful. You have bathrooms, and then in a separate room there's this little
the woman's face behind her is hilarious. Well, all of them, they're like, what the hell? But this one woman's face is looking at her like she just smelled something really bad, like, what the hell? What is this? This is hilarious.
Well, the mikveh, which is kind of like a little swimming pool, you prepare in one of the bathrooms that are, I mean, heated stone floors with beautiful products. You prepare by removing all intervening substances from your body, like nail polish, makeup, jewelry, comb out your hair, and then the mikveh attendant, another woman, brings you into the mikveh room. You immerse in the water, and you say a blessing. It's a time for women to pray, and the gates of heaven are open just for women at that moment. You say a blessing, and then husband and wife resume physical relationships, sexual relations.
So you don't see your husband for 12 days?
You see each other. You live in the same home. We just have separate beds, no hugging, no kissing, no touching. And then once that time ends and you immerse in the mikveh, everything becomes new again.
Now, what happens if you break the rule and he's like, oh, and you're like, oh, and you have relations?
We are totally committed to this. So it's what happens is there are laws during that time of separation that help you make it easy for you not to touch. You love each other. You live in the same home. We don't even pass things directly into each other's hands. And we don't hug or kiss. So nothing, you're not really doing anything that will lead to that, oh man, you know, we broke the rules.
Yes.
Because you're really living separately. You become kind of like roommates and best buddies. You get to develop the parts of your relationship. It's intellectual, emotional parts as a woman.
I can see a lot of women that are not Hasidic Jews that would probably love that part. Like, gosh, totally. 12 days, he ain't got to touch me.
Right.
I don't feel like doing anything. And then I love the end part where it's like the spa-like thing. And like that tradition is so beautiful.
Yeah, you get to go to the spa once a month.
That's fantastic.
And it's so exciting to be back with your husband again. And every touch becomes special again.
Very nice. We'll be right back.
Even Tyra's face at the end, she's like, we'll be right back. What the fuck? The woman's face behind her was just so beautiful. It was wonderful. Like, she couldn't even hide her disgust. I'm sure she, like, you know, if she watched that back, she'd think, oh, crap, I was making that face. But it was just great. Her instincts were saying, no. No. This is retarded. What? No. It's just so insane. Okay, now I'm going to read an article that was sent to me. Interesting. Assassination of Finnish reporters investigating bizarre Pizzagate plot puzzles Russia. An interesting Federal Security Service report circulating in the Kremlin today is expressing puzzlement / confusion over the assassination of two Finnish journalists who were interviewing a local politician about their ties to a human smuggling ring believed by Federation intelligence analysts to be controlled / organized by the current finance minister for Finland of... Sorry, for Finland, for his client / associate, Hillary Clinton, and his deaths are now linked to a bizarre / strange case in America known as Pizzagate. According to this report, FSB investigators headquartered in the Leningrad Oblast were called... Okay, this person is using slashes way too much. Were called / summoned to the village of Svetogorsk last December 2015 by local police authorities who had arrested a Finnish passport-holding citizen on the suspicion of him being a human trafficker after he was discovered trying to entice a 13-year-old boy, child Federation citizen, to travel with him to Imatra, Finland. That is 4 miles away from Svetogorsk. When FSB investigators interrogated this Finnish citizen, the report continues, they became alarmed / alerted after discovering on this person several rings and necklaces depicting images the U.S. Federal Bureau of Investigation had identified in 2007, emergency bulletin titled Symbols and Logos Used by Pedophiles to Identify Sexual Preferences, as being used by sex smuggler organizations to identify sexual preferences such as boy love, girl love, and child love. After an examination of this Finnish citizen's travel record throughout Europe and in an effort to uncover / discover the extent of the human smuggling crime organization he belonged to, this report notes FSB special agents began a joint investigation with Germany's Federal Intelligence Service, BND, and Italy's External Intelligence and Security Agency, AISE. In early May of this year, 2006, the report continues, FSB, BND, AISE investigators turned over to the Finnish Security Intelligence Service, SUPO, their initial investigative findings, and that resulted in the destruction of this international human smuggling ring by Finland's border police authorities. Frustratingly, however, this report notes SUPO investigators in Finland failed to answer many loose end questions posed by the FSB relating to the human smuggling ring, to include, 1, why were transport conveyances, boats, buses, planes, cars, etc., owned by a shell corporation linked to former Finnish Prime Minister and current Finance Minister Alexander Stubb and Imatra Council Leader Tiina Uilenjapien, used by these human smugglers? Why were numerous underage girl and boy children given training / instruction at the Vokensvanti restaurant in Imatra on preparing food, pizzas, sandwiches, salads, etc., and then provided with United States temporary hospitality worker E2 visas and then flown to America? Oh my gosh. With these and many other questions left unanswered in this international human smuggling investigation, this report details FSB investigators were receptive to a request last week from Finland's Uutisvoimat newspaper, located in Imatra, for a briefing on this investigation's findings, and who sent 2 of their reporters to review file notes about this still open FSB case.
Important to note, FSB analyst in this state, human trafficking in Finland's prosecuted as pandering, and as a result, the victims of the human smuggling sex trade are treated as witnesses and denied the right to a legal counsel and support persons and damages, and are not admitted to that nation's system of assistance for victims of human trafficking either. While reviewing the open case file on this human smuggling sex ring, this report continues, Finnish reporters were also briefed by FSB investigators on Federation documents alleging that Finland's finance minister, Alexander Stubb, is a long-known U.S. Central Intelligence Agency operative/agent whose father, Göran Stubb, was also employed by the CIA, and whose workings with the American National Hockey League allowed him access to many foreign nations, including Russia, to pay off media figures and support subversion. Having been educated in America during his secondary studies high school at Mainland High in Daytona Beach, Florida, this report details Minister Stubb, after completing his Finnish military service, returned to the U.S. attending Furman University in South Carolina, and where he also was recruited by CIA and was likewise recruited to the George Soros-funded Brookings Institute that trains/indoctrinates future world leaders on how to further the globalist agenda. With George Soros and a CIA backing, this report continues, Alexander Stubb rapidly ascended the political ladder in Finland, becoming the 64th prime minister, and who, while holding all of his positions of political power, continued the Finnish-American secret alliance against Russia and cooperated with the U.S. in the shameful torturing of war prisoners in secret CIA jails without either charges or trials. Most disturbing, though, about Minister Stubb while holding power in Finland, FSB analysts in the report say, was his April 2010 meeting with Hillary Clinton. That exactly coincides with the establishment of the human smuggling sex ring of young children being sent to the United States as hospitality workers. After informing Finnish journalists about all of these matters/concerns relating to this Stubb-Clinton-linked sex smuggling ring, the report says FSB investigators note that they left Svetogorsk, Russia, to return to Imatra, Finland, at 1300 hours on the 3rd of December. Less than 12 hours later, this report grimly states that these two female journalists, I cannot say their names, were assassinated in front of the Vukešvanti restaurant in Imatra, where they went to confront/question council leader Tina Wilén-Yapien, who was also killed. About this international smuggling sex ring and its links to her, Minister Stubb, and most importantly, Hillary Clinton. This report concludes by speculating that it is reasonable/possible to assume that this Stubb-Clinton international smuggling ring could have provided underage girls and boys to the so-called Pizzagate network in America. But with FSB analysts noting that, as of now, no evidence exists to prove this. So that's kind of interesting, those connections there. As we have stated many times, this, you know, is not just Hillary Clinton and the Democrats. That's, you know, tip of the iceberg stuff. This is everywhere. It's all over the world, all levels of power, and even people that don't have even that much power. This is just, Judaic cult shit getting way out of control. Okay, now, to go in another random direction, I've been looking into this theory that it sounds kind of crazy, but now that I've been looking into it a bit more, it doesn't sound so crazy. And I've heard it tossed around before. Now, there's a theory out there that the World Trade Center buildings were actually pretty much just like hollow shells of a building, that there actually weren't, you know, many businesses operating inside of here, and that it might have just been built, you know, with the purpose of being sacrificed. And yes, I assumed that before I looked into the possibility that there weren't actually floors or buildings, you know. I'm sorry, floors or offices in these buildings. It could have been built for sacrifice, even if it was an office, huge office building. But it seems that maybe there never were. I know there was like a hotel at the bottom. I know that you could take an elevator to go up to the top. But I mean, do we really know? I don't know. Has anyone ever been inside of the World Trade Center? Apparently I was as a baby. I went up to the top of it with my parents. I know my mom has stayed at the hotel there. but the hotel's on the bottom floor, I believe. So I don't know. And I'm also hearing that possibly the new Freedom Tower has no floors either. Building 7, I never saw it before it went down, but the new Building 7, to me, appears to actually have offices up there, and it's not as big. But yeah, this is weird.
So apparently it only took them 2 years to build a 110-story, office tower.
I mean, maybe that's possible. I don't know.
Okay, so you know how those Israeli artists, and I say that with air quotes because we know that they were not artists, they were just there probably either rigging explosives or just, you know, just doing what Jews do, being Jews. You know how they were able to light up the windows to say E-Team or whatever? It seems that they probably just put in a lighting system that, you know, could have made it look like there are actually lights on in these office buildings. It's possible, or they could have just taken the time to find out how to spell out E-Team and then, I don't know, somehow gotten into these offices to turn on the lights in these specific rooms, but I don't know. I think this is just a huge, like, I don't know if obelisk would be the proper name, but I don't know. They were trying to create some kind of something with this. I don't know if some people say a Stargate or, you know, it was a huge sacrifice on a very specific date and time, and there was a reason for it. They were trying to either open portals or derive power from this event. Some are even saying that it actually wasn't people jumping out of the buildings, that it was, you know, dummies. I don't know. And again, it's not that important. I just think thinking about these things is kind of interesting. It puts a whole new spin on, you know, their intentions, how they operate, how they screw with us. So, you know, I'm not looking to, like, fight people about this theory. I could really care less because it's over and done with. But I just think it's interesting to look into. So 2 weeks before the demolition of the World Trade Center towers in New York City, there was this work platform, and, you know, if you want a visual, it's like, you know, if you ever see those window cleaners, they're on those little platforms, you know, that they stand and they clean the windows. So there was a work platform parked high on the north side of the North Tower near the spot where the first of 4 ill-fated jumbo jets supposedly crash-landed. This mysterious platform was built and filmed for an obscure book written by foreign agents, Israeli agents, while living in America. In 2001, location, the North Tower of the World Trade Center, to be exact. There's even a really strange picture where it looks like it's the lobby of, you know, the bottom of the buildings, and there are some firefighters, and then there's what looks like these dummy things that are in boxes that are, like, just standing there. I don't know. It doesn't appear to be Photoshopped to me. Could be. But, like, what? What are these things doing there? Even if you look at some pictures with the light shining through the World Trade Center, it looks like there's no floors. Like, you can kind of see through. It's very weird. I don't know. Again, was that Photoshopped? I don't know. It's hard to know these days with all this stupid technology. So, there's also a super tall radio, it would be a radio mast, like an antenna at the top. So, super tall masts, the hardware of the Matrix. Masts belonging to various countries, such as those in Russia, seem to have had numerous incidents of fires, and in some cases sabotage over recent decades. But you need to dig to find this out, and it does not get reported on much. Wikipedia has a list of catastrophic collapses, which is very incomplete. Odd stories of sabotage appear and disappear. There are many spectacular non-building masts built over the last century. The Warsaw Radio Mast was the world's tallest structure, standing at 646.38 meters. That's 2,120.7 feet tall. Until its collapse on August 8, 1991. Most are hard or impossible to visit. The USA has dozens of radio masts over 600 meters tall. Some wild conspiracy theorists, quite unlike myself, have speculated that they could be broadcasting other more sinister types of signals, apart from regular radio communications, given the intense blanket coverage of the U.S. population. If you wrap your radio mast in an office building, i.e. a skyscraper, then this acts as a physical shield and also a human shield around it, assuming the building is actually occupied. Ultra-tall masts can be used for all sorts of things. That's a whole other story outside the scope of this article. It's on all fours, distilled batshit.
so interesting. I've seen, you know, the Empire State, when you walk in the lobby of the building, they have the Empire State with the antenna with like a bit, it looks like all these radio waves coming off of it. And it's almost like a big sun shining. It's weird. The main strategic function of the Twin Towers was to provide an upgrade to the existing main New York radio mast, this being the Empire State Building. Before the Empire State, the Chrysler Building was the main New York mast. The Twin Towers would add 100 meters of altitude. Compared to this, sorry, this text got kind of messed up. The replacement mast for the Twin Towers, known as the One World Trade Center, is assigned as a significant upgrade and adds another 100 meters to the altitude. The reason that the altitude of a radio mast is also important is described in my videos. I'll let you know whose blog this is in a second. There is no rational scientific explanation for why it would be important to build such tall masts on a spherical Earth, but you do not have to agree with me on this to understand what follows here. Firstly, I will run through a number of facts which I believe to be true, having intensely studied the subject for 14 years. The Truther movement has uncovered much of the truth, but of course there is endless disinfo and trickery of all kinds that must be navigated to ascertain the facts. I state the following to be true as far as I have been able to determine to the best of my abilities. This is my current state of knowledge. Spoiler alert, skip this if you want to keep believing in an external enemy that is not your own government. You know, he gets into how Al-Qaeda's CIA-backed and all this. We already know that, so I'll skip over that. Interesting, in the rubble, you really don't see, you don't see one office chair or desk. Now, some will say, well, that's because there was nanothermite and nuclear bombs, and everything was blown to bits and dust, and, I don't know. I don't really know. Hey, literally 110 stories, not 110 floors. Okay, this guy goes on. So I went on a hunt, and to my delight, found that I was right on the money. The Twin Towers were 108 stories tall, but were almost entirely hollow since being built, and only had a few floors. A second thing that tipped me off to this was when I read that a brand new technique was being used to hang floors between the central column and outside when they were built. Very complex and expensive per floor. If you're building the two buildings with the most floors ever, why would you pioneer the most expensive floor construction ever? It's bonkers until you realize that what they wanted to do was put in some floors at the top and middle and leave the rest hollow. The structure was also built 16 times as rigid as the typical tall building. This is now explained as having heavy floors at the top and not all the way down. I'm sorry, let me say that again. This is now explained as having heavy floors at the top and not all the way down, requires more rigidity in the structure. That was kind of a strange sentence. Okay. So I found the perfect photo to illustrate the hollow towers and then found several more corroborating my findings. Great care was taken during construction of the lower floors to hide it from the public, but shots taken later during construction and after construction show the truth. It seems rather remiss of both NIST and the opposition group Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth to have failed to notice the lack of floors. I guess their only excuse would be that they must have looked at the insured value of $4.5 billion and talked to Larry Silverstein and just assumed it must have been some floors despite the lack of debris. Perhaps the question simply didn't come up of whether there were floors in the building because it's usually given for most buildings and it's usually a given for most buildings that have been up for more than a few decades. Given their relaxed approach to such details, I'm surprised their huge A&E 9/11 Truth billboard didn't suffer a structural failure. Okay. This video clearly illustrates in many shots the many missing floors throughout the phases of construction. External fascia of the Twin Towers struck me as very unusual when I first saw them with my own eyes. I was struck by how ugly they were, because the outside had such narrow windows and so much vertical metalwork that it was impossible to see in. This, of course, was the intention. Only a few choice moments of light shining through the photos give the game away. So there were no floors apart from the sky lobby, the floor where you change lift to go to the top, and the windows on the World restaurant where they had a lovely cup, where I had a lovely cup of tea in the year 2000, perfectly brewed. But as always in New York, the UHT milk on the side was just wrong. Maybe a few other floors, certainly not many. To
Tourists would go up and down to the restaurant and never suspect a thing. Ushers would make sure they didn't accidentally try to visit any other floors. I was struck at the time by the weirdly empty lobby that was six stories high, and the ushers who seemed to watch the tourists like a hawk. No doubt the staff were turned over frequently, and new joiners told the weird lack of office workers was due to some building's work going on. This must have been the story for all those decades. So the buildings were actually similar to the CN Tower, a tall concrete radio mast with a restaurant at the top, but with a nice disguise. They could be insured for $1.5 billion or whatever by Larry Silverstein because everyone pretended they were real office buildings for decades. So there was a huge insurance fraud planned from the outset. The questions about what happened to the workers and were they tipped off, etc., are answered by the fact that there were no workers or very few ever. I mean, this sounds pretty plausible to me. It would be a lot easier to do something like this. Okay, you can read all about the occupancy history of the buildings, which was released under a FOIA request here, unless you prefer Zyopedia, which seems to show fresh shenanigans. Okay, it was a pretty lightly used building throughout its lifetime. Even after one considers an over 90% shortfall of floors, some paranoid people might think it odd that all these massive skyscrapers that should house, say, 100 companies are so hush-hush about their tenants, who are always surprisingly few in number. I suppose so long as they keep paying the rent, it is of no proper concern of the landlord whether the tenants actually exist or whether they are actually using the building, unless perhaps they require the installation of some floors. Seems like all these famous landmarks are a kind of Truman Show for us all. Definitely. Very, very, very strange. So now getting into gelatin, the Israeli spy ring that were posing as artists. Took over a floor of the World Trade Center for some years and can be seen with boxes of B-8 fuses that were used to rig the structure with thermite charges supplemented by kerosene for the big explosion of the plane hit. Squibs are seen going off during the demolition, but only on the really existing floors. The fact that there were hardly any floors explains the freefall demolition. Absolutely. Gelatin also had plenty of time to obtain the footage of people hanging out of the windows when they constructed a walkway and had a helicopter take photos of them. These images were then used to create the fake jumper footage of the people trapped in the upper floors. In reality, the buildings were, of course, evacuated and demolished. I do not know if any loss of life was genuine. Perhaps the firefighter deaths were real. I do not know. I'd say most likely, yes, they were. I'd say they were the sacrifice. Okay. But certainly this account for the lack of floor debris and corpses as nobody really worked in the building makes sense. A lot of their apparently extant relatives do seem unusually fast and loose with the truth. Okay, very, very interesting. So the new super high-tech ultra-secret spire of the new One World Trade Center at 54.1 million is reportedly 800 tons in weight. I do not know if the WTC could have supported that load. Probably not. It was good to see someone else doing research on this from Wikipedia. Okay, so in March 2014, the tower was scaled by a 16-year-old New Jersey resident, Justin Caseo, who entered the site through a hole in a fence. He was subsequently arrested on trespassing charges. He allegedly dressed like a construction worker, sneaked in, and convinced an elevator operator to lift him to the tower's 88th floor. According to the news sources, he then used stairways to get to the 104th floor, walked past a sleeping security guard, and climbed up a ladder to get to the antenna, where he took pictures for 2 hours. The elevator operator was reassigned, and the guard was fired. It was then revealed that officials had failed to install security cameras in the tower. It is not clear from this story whether Mr. Caseo managed to alert the owners to the lack of floors, which could lead to a dangerous freefall collapse of the new one. So case closed. I'm sorry it took me 14 years to make this deduction while the perpetrators have dined out endlessly on this anti-Muslim atrocity propaganda stunt. These PNAC clowns turned a routine radio mast upgrade into a huge war on terror launch party. The Israeli guest magicians were channeling Michael Bay meets David Copperfield. Gelatin's artists were not even a cover story. The emperor's new clothes were at least 90% less splendid than advertised, and that's just not cricket. I don't know what that means. Hopefully this information will wake people up to and help to bring an end to the media-manufactured enmity between Islam and the West.
Oh, and by the way, radio mass transmissions made by Nikola Tesla proved the Earth is flat over a century ago. They were covered up, but some later 1915 broadcast gave the game away, as explained in my video below. It's called Flat Earth New Proof, Impossible Radio Transmissions. So I hope you all get super triggered by that.
Defeated the beast's only rival.